Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The sculptor Augusta Savage once said, "I was a leap year baby, and it seems to me that I've been leaping ever since." Savage was a black woman from the Jim Crow South. She leapt to public attention during the Harlem Renaissance, but she's not very well known today. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg says an exhibition at the New York Historical Society will bring her new acclaim.
This is her most famous work. It's called Gammon.
In 2002, a small portrait bust by Augusta Savage was brought to Antiques Roadshow.
I think you might be surprised. This is worth between $15,000 and $20,000.
With a crack?
With the crack, yes.
That's wonderful. I cannot believe that.
13 years later, Roadshow reevaluated the piece. $8,000. Augusta Savage made the sculpture around 1929 in plaster. She couldn't afford bronze, so she covered the white plaster in brown paint mixed with shoe polish. Gammon is a child of the streets, an urchin in a soft cap, a wrinkled shirt, and dignity, pride in his eyes.
What's so remarkable about this work is that, quite simply, it presented an African-American child in a realistic and humane fashion.
Not as some stereotype, derided, demeaned. Thousands of kids came to see Gammon on exhibit.
And they saw themselves as fine art.
Wendy Ikimoto curated the Savage Show in New York. It was organized by the Kummer Museum in Jacksonville, Florida, near where the artist was born.
Green Cove Springs was a brick-making town because it had all of this natural red clay. And so Savage would seek out those red clay pits as a child. And she says that at the mud pie age, she stopped making mud pies and started making things.
Savage's father, a fundamentalist minister, disapproved. To him, her little clay figures were graven images. He punished her.
Savage recounts later, "My father licked me 5 or 6 times a week and nearly whipped all the art out of me."
But a teacher spotted the girl's talent and encouraged it. Eventually, with $4.60 in her pocket, she moved to Harlem, cleaned houses to pay her rent, and began to study art. At 30, she got a scholarship to an art school in Paris. But when the American Selection Committee found out she was black, they reneged. Their reason? White Southern girls might object.
That they would feel uncomfortable sharing accommodations on the ship, sharing a studio, sharing living spaces. And the way that these committee members expressed that decision and the justification for it, they were concerned about Savage. It would be uncomfortable for her.
Savage got there anyway.
She did. 6 years later, she spent 3 years there, and she exhibited. She won awards.
Back in Harlem during the Depression, Savage turned her studio into a school and gave free art lessons. Jacob Lawrence, noted painter of the great African-American migration north, was one of her students. The school was an early step in her lifetime of social activism.
Free,
Throughout the 1930s, Savage sculpted portrait busts of African-American leaders, including NAACP leader James Weldon Johnson, who wrote the words to this anthem. The 1939 New York World's Fair commissioned her to sculpt a monumental work. It's called The Harp.
The strings of the harp are formed by the folds of choir robes worn by 12 African-American singers. Then the soundboard of the harp is formed by the hand of God.
The singers then became instruments of God. 5 million visitors saw the harp, and it became one of the fair's most photographed objects, 16 feet high, made of painted plaster. Augusta Savage didn't have the money to cast it in bronze.
So, at the end of the World's Fair, the work was destroyed. It was smashed by bulldozers during the fair's cleanup.
Augusta Savage died in 1962, a little-known, completely dedicated product of determination and the Harlem Renaissance. The retrospective of her work is at the New York Historical Society through July 28th. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
It's not racism.
While so much of today's news from Washington naturally focuses on the political life here, there is another well-known part of the nation's capital that's all about America's history and art. That is the sprawling Smithsonian Institution, which houses more than 150 million artifacts and works of art and attracts some 30 million visitors a year. In May, the Smithsonian named its newest secretary, Lonnie Bunch III. And last week, I caught up with him at one of the museums he oversees, Air and Space. It was his first national TV interview since taking office and part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas. Lonnie Bunch has come home.
What's his to my eyes, too, going to tell you now?
Thank you.
I'm proud of you, sir.
Well, thank you. You guys are the best. Take care. Right.
Bunch calls his position 40 years ago as an education specialist and historian at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum his first real job.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yes, sir.
All right. Good to see you all. Take
yes,
care.
Sir.
Portraits of the Smithsonian secretaries through the years line the halls of the main administrative building. Now, Bunch is the first African-American to lead this revered institution in its 173-year history, the world's largest museum, education, and research complex.
If man could accomplish these kinds of things, as long as you're educated, you can contribute to making a country better. This was tied to my parents' commitment to education, and it was trying to figure out how do these things work, how did this happen, and it really created a kind of inquisitive nature, trying to understand life. We spent many an hour talking about going to the moon, talking about philosophy, talking about literature.
Bunch grew up in Belleville, New Jersey, where he and his family were the only African Americans after his grandfather, a former sharecropper, moved to the area as one of the first black dentists in the region. Bunch also has worked at the National Museum of American History and led the Chicago Historical Society. Then he was the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, one of the hottest tickets in Washington. Bunch says he believes every part of the Smithsonian can drive home the importance of history to everyday life.
There is something so powerful about seeing the stuff, you know, and so you want people to engage and feel that feeling of the richness of an artifact. The Smithsonian is a place that is much about today and tomorrow as it is about yesterday.
Bunch is the first museum director to become secretary in decades.
This was in the Museum of American History.
We talked in his office about the challenges that lie ahead as he now oversees a $1.6 billion annual budget that supports 19 museums free to the public, 9 research centers, 21 libraries, and the National Zoo.
29 years you've spent one way or another connected to the Smithsonian. What does it mean to now be the head of it, the secretary?
Well, it's both humbling and frightening. So for me, it's about helping the Smithsonian be the place that is the glue for America and that helps America grapple with who it is, help us understand itself and its world.
There are a lot of firsts connected with you, the first historian to become the secretary?
I think being a first historian means that you view the world through a different lens. You're always looking at how do you contextualize, how do you help people understand by looking back. And so what I hope is that I can help the whole Smithsonian be the place that people look to, not just to visit, but for answers to help them live their lives.
You grew up at a time when this country was very much in the throes of a civil rights conflict.
Right. What it meant is that I had to learn to negotiate race at an early age. And one of the ways I tried to do that was by looking at history, by understanding the history of this town, because I wanted to understand why some people treated me wonderfully and other people treated me horribly. I remember walking to elementary school, there were these little girls that would sit on a porch. And as I walked by, they would always yell, "Oh, God left you in the oven too long. You're too dark." And I didn't understand that. And I thought that history would be my way of understanding myself. And then later I realized history was my way to understand the country. And it helped me understand that the key for my success is to embrace ambiguity, to understand that I've got to be nimble, to understand that there are shades of gray, and that in essence it taught me that there were no simple answers.
Do you come into this job with fully formed ideas about what you want the Smithsonian to be?
Well, I think in some ways it is recognizing that the Smithsonian is unbelievably venerated and visited, and now the question is how it can be of value in traditional ways, doing great exhibitions, wonderful educational programs, but how it also can give people tools to live their lives, to understand climate change, to understand ethnicity and race, to understand scientific innovation. Well, you think about the products that we create and to make sure they have a contemporary resonance. So, for example, if you think about Deep Time in the Dinosaur Hall, what is so powerful about that is, yes, it reflects all the new science, but it also raises issues of environment and climate.
And you mentioned climate change as something that you want to incorporate into the perspective.
Well, I think it's already there, and so the key is to just be clearer with it so people understand not that there is a political agenda, but that we're really saying the Smithsonian is an educational institution, and it's our opportunity and responsibility to help you understand the world you're grappling with today. So to make sure that what we're doing is not just educating within our spaces, but really shaping the educational system of America.
And how do you do that?
One of the ways to do it is to create a virtual Smithsonian, is to recognize that millions and millions of people come to the Smithsonian every year, but millions more will never have that opportunity. So for me, it's really trying to find the balance between the traditions and innovation.
You've written about the influence of politics and funding on museums. It doesn't get any more intense here in Washington. We are now living in what I think most people believe is the most politically polarized time since maybe even the Civil War in this country. How do you navigate that?
Well, partly I learned a lot in Chicago. Chicago's politics are pretty interesting as well. But I think that the reality is that the Smithsonian is nonpartisan. I feel that I have a very strong relationships on the Hill and in the White House, and that my notion is that everybody who cares about America should care about the Smithsonian.
You've talked openly about your commitment to diversity. Is the Smithsonian today as diverse as you want it to be in every respect?
No. The Smithsonian has done a much better job, and we're very good, better on issues of gender. I won't be the secretary just in search of diversity and inclusion, but it's real clear to me that we can't be the institution that matters to Americans if we don't reflect that diversity.
I ask in part because some people say, well, wait a minute, are we going to see a Latino American museum, a museum of American women in history, museum of the LGBT community? How do you think about all that? Because we know there are pressures to come up with something to serve each one of these communities.
My whole career has been about expanding the canon, making sure that the history, the culture that is explored reflects the diversity of America. So that's not going to stop. I think that at this stage, it's up to Congress to determine whether or not we build new museums.
With so many big decisions to make, Bunch said he likes to surround himself with a few reminders of the Smithsonian's massive collection that have personal meaning for him.
Well, I think if you look at the Ho is taller than she is. The basket is heavy. Her arm is straining.
The 1890s photo by Rudolf Eichemeyer of a woman in North Carolina is titled Return to the Fields.
I make sure it's with me wherever I am, and I can always see it. So no matter how bad the day is, I'm saying, it's better than what she's got.
Bunch says he hopes everyone who comes to the Smithsonian will find inspiration as he has.
The breadth of the Smithsonian is part of the wonder of it. And I don't ever want to lose that. I don't want to ever lose where you can walk from understanding dinosaurs and gems to understanding race, to looking at the history of the American presidency, to suddenly looking at the lunar lander and recognize how central science is to the world that we live in today. So that, to me, is the great joy of the Smithsonian.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
And now, for a Republican perspective, I'm joined by Representative James Comer of Kentucky. Congressman Comer, welcome back to the NewsHour. What do you make of President Trump's comments yesterday and today about these four women of color who are members of Congress?
Well, I certainly do not think the president's a racist. I believe the president shares a lot of Americans' frustration with Congress, particularly those four women congressmen who, for no other reason, constantly criticizes not only the president, but also Congress and our country. I think there's a level of frustration that the president has that he unfortunately took out in a probably not the best worded tweet. But I think that the tweet's been overblown. And I think that we really need to move on and talk about the issues in Congress that the American people care about.
You said, unfortunately. What was it about the tweet that you think the president should not have said?
Well, there's just been the whole term racism has been thrown around in Congress a lot more over the last 2 months than I've ever heard the word used. Just last week, you had Ocasio-Cortez basically call Pelosi racist for some of the comments that she made about women of color. And when you're a member of Congress, when you're the president of the United States, and you get to this level, and the debate is this contentious, and you've got an American electorate that's equally divided, sometimes your emotions take control and you say things that you don't necessarily mean, and sometimes things come out differently than you intended.
You mentioned your constituents. What are they telling you?
Well, I was in Kentucky all weekend. I was at the airport in Louisville this morning, talked to a lot of people from all across my district and all across Kentucky. And I can tell you, my people are not offended by the tweets. They've become accustomed to the president's tweets. I have told the president in conversations that I feel like he would be better served if he didn't tweet as much. But I think we all know that the president is going to continue to tweet. That's his way of doing things. It's gotten him this far. I personally would like to see a more civil Congress, a more civil tone between both parties and the national news media. But I don't think that's going to happen. But as far as the people in the district, they still strongly support the president. They support the president's agenda. And they know that he shares their frustration with a lot of the policies that those four members of Congress continue to espew. It doesn't seem like they're for securing the border. It doesn't seem like they are for any type of civil debate that the average taxpayer in my district would support.
You say it's not racist in your view, and yet each one of these women is a woman of color.
Right. And, you know, it's no different, in my opinion, than the national media saying when they talk about the presidential debates, well, the Democrat base doesn't want Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden because they're a white male. I don't view that as racist. I don't view the president's tweets as racist. I wish the tone were better. But what we do here when I go back home, and most of my Republican colleagues here back home, is why can't you all secure the border? Why can't you all balance the budget? Why can't you all fix prescription drug prices? These are the issues that Americans care about. And I think that, there are, unfortunately, people in America who were probably somewhat offended by the tweet. But at the end of the day, I don't think that the tweet deserves the amount of press coverage that it's gotten.
One other thing, Congressman, what do you make of the president's conversation statements over the last number of weeks that he intends for there to be massive roundups of undocumented immigrants in this country? Now, we haven't seen that happen, but the president has talked about it a good deal. What do you make of that?
What the president is experiencing right now, as witnessed by his tweets and some of his statements, is he's frustrated that Congress won't support his agenda that he feels like is the same agenda he campaigned on, the same promises he made during the campaign. And he's also frustrated that the tone, especially by the four female congresswomen who we're talking about today, who were referenced in the president's tweets, their constant, trashing of ICE. You know, the border agents are trying to do their job to secure the border. These facilities where we have all these migrants, they weren't built to house the number of people that they're housing. They certainly weren't built to house children. So, those four female members of Congress are constantly criticizing the president over things that really aren't his fault. You know, he was elected to secure the border. You know, build the wall was one of the main talking points in his campaign. But yet we have an open border and we have people coming in the United States. It's a drain on the Treasury. It's a drain on law enforcement. And, you know, I think that because of the Democrats in Congress and their inaction on doing anything about border security, the president's very frustrated. And when he gets frustrated, we know he goes to Twitter.
Congressman James Comer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I am not prejudiced.
President Trump is, as you know, facing criticism after he tweeted over the weekend that four Democratic congresswomen should go back to where they came from. But a lot of people who voted for the president still support him. Olivia Rheingold of Yellowstone Public Radio went to a shooting range in Billings, Montana, and talked to some people there. At Black Butte Range, Jerome Hall is showing a customer how to shoot a semi-automatic weapon.
Slap. You can use the bottom portion of your hand. You can slap that handle right there down. Okay.
Hall is a military veteran who served in Afghanistan. Now he's the gunsmith at the range. When he first saw Trump's tweet, he thought it was funny, and still does.
It just makes me giggle that everybody's all up in arms about this.
That's because he doesn't think Trump was making a racial comment, but rather one about the places these congresspeople represent.
Trump saying they need to go back to their country is pretty much him saying, go back to California, go back to New York.
He wonders if Trump misspoke and meant to say state rather than country. Following Trump's weekend tweet, Montana's Republican U.S. Senator Steve Daines tweeted his own support for the president. It read, quote, Montanans are sick and tired of listening to anti-American, anti-Semite, radical Democrats trash our country and our ideals. This is America. We're the greatest country in the world. I stand with @RealDonaldTrump, end quote. That's not necessarily a controversial statement in Montana, where Trump won by 20% in the popular vote against Democrat Hillary Clinton.
Thank you for calling the Black Butte Range. This is Andrew. How can I help you?
Black Butte Range co-owner Andrew Stapleton is a Montana native who says he doesn't agree with everything President Trump does, but he stands by him when it comes to the controversial tweets.
Essentially, how I read this is don't throw rocks if you live in a glass house.
Meaning that if the four Democratic congresswomen that Trump was referring to can't solve problems in their own districts, they shouldn't dish out criticism of the president's policies. Stapleton says Trump's tweets weren't about race or nationality.
It just has to do with go back and fix your areas, and then you can try to fix my area.
Montana native Tanner Lineberry came into the range to purchase an extended slide stop for his handgun.
It helps the gun go boom.
He sells building supplies to construction companies and calls himself a Trump supporter, mostly because of the economy.
But it's true. Like, the economy is very strong right now. The numbers don't really lie.
But he says Trump's wins go beyond the economy.
Working on policy, foreign policy, too. Going and meeting with leaders that they've never had progress with those people before. Presidents haven't.
So he's not too worried about the tweets or the controversy that's followed. He says they're a distraction from the president's accomplishments. Lineberry says he's been watching Fox News in his office all day and reads the tweet just one more time to make sure he got it right.
then come back and show us how.
Reaction.
I mean, it doesn't sound like they really want to be here. So, like, I agree. They should probably, if they don't want to be here, they should probably go somewhere else.
He says Trump will have his support in 2020 so long as he doesn't go after gun rights. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Nearly 2 years ago, the Me Too movement galvanized women who work in and around the Washington legislature. Now a new conversation is emerging about race, equity, and inclusiveness at the statehouse. That topic received fresh urgency recently after one Democratic lawmaker's comments about racism, sexism, and misogyny behind closed doors. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
It was at a legislative wrap-up event hosted by the Kent Chamber of Commerce as newly elected Democratic State Senator Mona Das took the mic. She jettisoned her plans to talk about the legislature's accomplishments. Instead, she said this.
And what I want to talk to you about is get a little real. Is anyone ready for some reality? Anyone?
Das is Indian American, and she went on to talk about the challenges of being a woman of color in political office. And she got specific. She invoked her fellow Senate Democrats and their conduct when they meet in private in caucus.
And after they close that door, that's when it gets real. That's when my 28 colleagues got real. And that's when I heard hate. That's when I heard misogyny and racism and sexism from people you would not expect.
Needless to say, Das's comments made headlines. She later clarified to the Associated Press that she was talking about coded language, not overt acts of racism or sexism. And Das says what she heard in the caucus room is really no different from what she hears in a lot of settings, where different demographic groups are talked about as the other. Nonetheless, the Senate's human resources officer is now conducting an investigation. Meanwhile, Das says she's apologized to her colleagues for her strong language, but she says she doesn't regret what she said.
I believe that this has opened a conversation that has been an elephant in the room for a really long time. And now we're having these conversations honestly, authentically, deeply, and coming from a place of love.
In the Washington House, Democratic State Representative Christine Reeves is also thinking about equity and diversity in the context of modernizing the legislative work environment. She says that when she first arrived in the legislature in 2017, she was the only African-American woman, and she quickly had a realization.
This institution really wasn't built for, you know, at the time for me, as a working mom, as a woman, as a person of color.
Reeves says in the wake of the Me Too movement, she wants the legislature to look more deeply at how it's structured and how it functions. And she's considering introducing legislation next year to create a joint select committee on legislative workplace modernization. But Reeves is already anticipating some pushback.
Ultimately, anytime folks challenge, you know, the way the institution works or the way things have always been done, there's going to be resistance. There's going to be fear. There's going to be concern.
Now, over the last couple of years, Washington voters have elected a much more diverse group of lawmakers to the legislature. Republican State Senator Shelley Short says she welcomes a conversation about how to make the legislature work better for everyone, women, people of color, working families. But speaking by cell phone, Short says she worries that the conversation the Democrats want to have around race and equity runs the risk of becoming divisive.
While I agree it needs to come forward, you know, how they're doing it, I think actually makes it harder.
Short describes the legislature as a pressure cooker environment, and she says that if lawmakers are worried about how what they say is construed, it could have a chilling effect and make it harder to build relationships and work across party lines.
And my concern is it's really a dividing and conquering thing, not actually how do we take all of our unique talents and our unique backgrounds and work together.
As for Senator Das, she says as Washington's legislature becomes more diverse, it's important for the institution to evolve some of its historic practices. One example, she says she was told as a first-year senator that it was customary to listen but not speak in caucus. Das says she wasn't singled out for that advice.
But when you say something like that to a woman of color who's used to being silenced her whole life, it impacted me very differently.
I think that that's a great example of us learning as an institution.
That's Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig. He says Das's comments at the Kent Chamber of Commerce fit into a larger and growing conversation in the legislature about race and equity.
When I arrived in the Senate 7 years ago, these conversations weren't happening at all.
Billig says he's proud of the steps that have already been taken. He points to the diversity of his leadership team, a new legislative code of conduct, and new workplace standards trainings. But he also acknowledges there's more work to be done. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Now we're going to cross over to Brooklyn, where a new play is being performed at theater for a new audience. It's called Fairview, and it's won all kinds of acclaim, a Pulitzer Prize for playwright Jackie Sibley's Drury, and applause from critics who've called it dazzling, ruthless, unsettling, disturbing. The story centers on a middle-class African-American family, and we find them in their carefully decorated townhouse as wife Beverly prepares a birthday dinner for her demanding mother with the help of loving husband Dayton and overachieving daughter Keisha. And it all seems like something out of a 70s sitcom until things start to get really, really weird. And that's about all I'm going to say right now, because the ordinariness of it all becomes central to the play's final punch. We caught up with Jackie Sibley's Drury recently to talk with her about the play, and she told us that the idea of this very ordinary African-American family being watched by onlookers was key to developing the play.
Initially, when I was talking to the director, Sarah Benson, we were both really interested in thinking about surveillance and sort of why surveillance affects people of color in a deeper way. And this idea of being watched by someone as a person of color, there's automatically some sort of sense of suspicion, especially if the watcher is a white person. And so we sort of started from a place of trying to create what in the theater felt like a normal black family, and then introducing the idea of someone watching that family and that watching changing their behavior and the course of their lives.
Do you remember initially what got you thinking about it? I mean, I understand that a number of artists across genres have been thinking a very great deal about what it means to be in the present moment. I mean, especially kind of going from the Obama era to the Trump era. Mm. It just, there have been a number of things in recent years that have really shaken the artistic community and the country on the whole. Was there any incident in particular or something, some event in particular that got you started thinking about this particular play at this particular time?
Well, I guess it definitely feels as though the current political moment has like affected the way that the play is developed, and also the way that the actors have approached their performances, and also the way that the play exists in the audience's mind. But to be totally honest, I think that at least the initial idea came from a sort of personal experience where I was spending some time in a contested region in North Africa with my husband, who's an anthropologist. And we were just aware of being actively surveilled by police in that area. And there was something about the surveillance being embodied, like you could see a dude wearing a sweater walking behind you. It just felt more low tech and in person than I was used to thinking about surveillance, but it also didn't feel completely unfamiliar. There was a lot about being a person of color in America that experience of someone watching me with suspicion, sort of expecting me to do something ill or bad or illegal, that felt familiar. And so that really was the impetus, at least for me.
One of the things about the play that has been so interesting, you know, to watch people write about is that a lot of the critics who normally in writing about plays kind of make themselves invisible, or they sort of imply that their view of the thing is the view that anybody would have. And one of the things that's so fascinating about the play itself is the way you make the audience, including the critics, kind of question the way they're looking at it. It's one of those things where you sort of can't escape the way you look at it really has a lot to do with who you are and who you were when you walked into that theater. And I was just fascinated by how you pulled that off. Like, did you start out with the idea of saying, you know, I'm going to invite you to experience what I experience all the time.
Like, basically, and like, that was so well put, Michelle. Thank you for that. Also, like, the play tries to point to whiteness not as the norm or not as invisible, but as a particular vantage that can be damaging to other races. And not all of the critics that wrote reviews of the play are white, but most critics for theater are white. And so it was really, I thought, neat to see people sort of engage with that and talk about their place in this ecosystem of art and criticism and journalism. It was really exciting.
Why theater for you? Is this is not your first play. I do want to point out that this is not the first play that you've had mounted, and it's certainly not even the first one that's been critically acclaimed, but this has certainly made a big splash. I was wondering, you know, why theater as opposed to sitcoms or the movies for you? Why is that your preferred form, at least for now?
I grew up as like a theater dork who like memorized all the lyrics to Rent and Les Mis, and that like I was in plays in elementary school, after school, always. And so I feel like even as I like grew older and experienced other things, that I really like the form. I like that you have to be in a room with other people. I like that you hear people cough and you get annoyed at people who have big hair sitting in front of you, and that there's just like this crazy embodied experience. And so I like that a lot of different people can come into a room and have a similar point of focus, but really, really different experiences. And that just is inspiring to me.
That was playwright Jackie Sibley's Drury, her play Fairview, won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Drama.
Why haven't you learned anything?
The statistics suggest that the U.S. legal profession has a long way to go when it comes to diversity. In 2017, about 85% of lawyers in the United States were white. While the number of minorities and women practicing law has been slowly increasing over the last decade, some law schools, including Harvard, want to move the needle faster. As WBUR's Carrie Young reports, they're starting by taking a closer look at the law school admissions test, also known as the LSAT.
Soon-to-be Harvard law student Olivia Castor says she has strong feelings about the LSAT. First, it was expensive.
For my books, let's see, I spent about $300. And then I also had a tutoring session. I spent $2,015.
Castor took the LSAT last summer and says for about 4 months, preparing for the exam practically took over her life.
I studied March through June, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Saturday I would do a full-length test. So I was sitting around the clock, and at that point I was also working full-time.
But it wasn't just the expense that Castor struggled with.
When I first started studying, I had no idea what I was doing, and I didn't have any friends who were also studying for the LSAT.
She explains both of her parents are immigrants, and they didn't know much about the process of applying to law school. She says navigating it all on her own felt intimidating. It's stories like Castor's that pushed officials like Mark Miller, the dean of the University of Arizona Law School, to look for other standardized tests to use in admissions a few years ago.
We went with the GRE because it's so familiar and is now a basis for admissions to many different kinds of graduate programs and to business school.
The University of Arizona was the first accredited law school to offer applicants the option to submit a GRE score instead of an LSAT score in 2016. The American Bar Association requires a standardized test for admission. And for years, law schools assumed that meant the LSAT. But Miller's team showed the GRE could work too.
This was our idea, and I'm proud of that.
Some legal publications criticized the school initially, saying diversity goals were just a cover, and the GRE policy was really about revenue or filling more seats. But then, about a year later...
So we announced acceptance of the GRE in March 2017.
Harvard Law School did the same thing. Christy Jobson, the assistant dean for admissions, says improving diversity in the legal profession is something she takes personally and the GRE policy seemed like a step in that direction.
As a practicing attorney myself and as a woman in the profession, I can tell you, riding the elevator up a fancy New York City law firm, you feel it. And walking down the courtroom hallway, you feel the lack of diversity in the profession.
Today, about 24 law schools have followed suit and accept GRE scores. So how does a test improve diversity? Well, when you talk to admissions officials, some of it boils down to simple logistics. The GRE is offered almost daily at thousands of testing centers across the world.
Conversely, the LSAT is not offered everywhere. In most countries, it's only offered once per year, maybe twice. And even here in the United States, it's only offered 9 times per year.
Then there's the test itself. Testing experts like Glenn Storr with Kaplan Test Prep say the GRE feels similar to standardized tests most college students have taken before, like the SAT.
The LSAT is unique in that it is really a wholly skills-based test.
And those skills are not as familiar to the average college grad, like a section in the legal world known as logic games, which are complex word problems that test analytical reasoning. Storr says this part strikes the most fear in the students he works with. But he adds the good news is
everyone can learn these skills.
But that often takes resources, and getting the right tools to help you perform competitively can be expensive. Most classes today can cost around $1,000. Tutors are even more expensive. And factors like that can make applying to law school feel out of reach for a lot of people. After 3 years, Dean Mark Miller at the University of Arizona says the GRE policy seems to be working. Officials at Harvard Law School are reporting similar results. Again, Assistant Dean of Admissions Christy Jobson.
In both years of acceptance, individuals who submitted the GRE, only the GRE, were more likely to be international, more likely to have significant work experience, more likely to have a prior graduate degree. They were also more likely to be from an underrepresented racial or ethnic group.
But the makers of the LSAT, the Law School Admission Council, pushed back on the criticism. Lily Knezovich, the organization's senior vice president for learning and assessment, points to the LSAT's origin story. In the 1940s, it was created to be an equalizer.
The legal educators at the time the test was developed felt we want open access to anyone who can do the work, and definitely to get away from the old boy network.
But as times change, Knezovich says the council is looking for ways to adapt. The organization recently increased the number of days the test is offered. The council also launched a new partnership with the Khan Academy, an education nonprofit, to provide free online test prep classes. Still, critics of standardized testing say law schools should go further and ditch the test requirement altogether. But law school accreditors say making that leap is tough. Law school is expensive, and they want some way to predict if a student will succeed. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Young.
Little brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A. Word, word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina. Word.
Black landowners in the South avoided writing wills for generations. Instead, they relied on informal agreements to keep property in the family. But these heirs' property transfers have had devastating consequences. The USDA even says they're the leading cause of involuntary land loss for Black families. A new article from ProPublica explores why African Americans continue to lose their farmland and how this problem is hitting home, especially in North Carolina. Reporter Lizzie Presser homes in on the story of two brothers in Carteret County. They spent 8 years in jail for refusing to leave their family's land. Lizzie joins me now. Lizzie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Anita.
Tell me about the Reels brothers, who they are, and what their relationship is to this piece of land in Carteret County.
I'd love to. So Melvin and LaCurtis Reels are two brothers in Carteret who live on a 65-acre tract that their great-grandfather bought in 1911, just when he was one generation removed from slavery. They've grown up on this land and lived on it all their lives, and Melvin in particular has created a local economy on that shore. So they live on the Intracoastal Waterway, and he became a very successful shrimper. And he brought in a ton of money to the area. It's the little area is called Merriman, where he was teaching the men in the neighborhood how to work the water, and he was paying women in the neighborhood how to prepare the catch. But what happened was their grandfather, Mitchell Reels, died without a will in 1970, and that's when a lot of their problems with ownership began. And for the past 40 years, they have been fighting a battle against the law, in many cases, to keep their property.
So they lost their property due to a series of loopholes related to it being heirs' property. And I want you to explain to us, in the least legalese you can, what what heirs' property is and how this impacted the Reels brothers.
So heirs' property is a kind of ownership where descendants inherit an interest in land. And it's kind of like holding stock in a company. So if there isn't a will, this is how land is passed down. And for many families, this has been how land has been passed down for generations. So you can have dozens or even hundreds of family members who co-own a piece of land. And it's an especially unstable form of ownership. And that operates at a number of levels. On the first level, you can't gain access to private financing often. You can't gain access to federal home improvement loans or certain USDA programs or even FEMA funding because you can't use your land as collateral. But then on the second level, which is probably the worst level, is that you're at a very high risk of losing your land. And in the piece, I describe a number of legal mechanisms whereby speculators can acquire your property, often at pennies on the dollar. And you'll see Black families. I watched families watch on as their land was sold on courthouse steps or forced into sales against their will.
So these families become vulnerable to losing their land because of this heir's property, which means that it was passed down, as you said. They inherited it, but there was no formal will. And almost 76% of African Americans don't have a will. Can you talk about this bigger problem and how it impacts the ability to pass on land?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, what's really interesting about that 76% figure is it's twice the rate of white Americans who die without a will. And there's a long legacy of this, and it's very much a legacy of Jim Crow. So there was good reason for Black families to be suspicious of white Southern courts under Jim Crow. And many just decided to live with this kind of alternative form of land ownership where they were avoiding the courts. And as a result, what we see now are people who have inherited or continue to inherit heirs' property with very little recourse to fix it. So it's incredibly complex and expensive to clear title to property and to consolidate ownership. You have to track down every living heir. And there's been very little movement at the federal level and at state levels to fix that.
So there are also essentially ways that outside interests can kind of pit families against one another in ways that make them lose their land. Can you tell us about that and how it fits into the story of these brothers in particular?
Yeah, I'd love to. I think that's a really big part of the story. I mean, I would first want to just step back and say that when we're talking about heirs' property, we're not talking about a small problem. We're talking about a major problem. This is a third of Southern Black-owned lands. It's been estimated to be over 3.5 million acres worth more than $28 billion in the South. You were asking about, what were you asking? What did I just miss your question?
No, you didn't. I think you were on your way to answering it. We were talking about how outside interests pit families against one another and how that
right.
can lead to land loss.
Right. So a lot of the time what ends up happening is that financial incentives are dangled in front of family members who no longer live on the property. So these can be relatives who live up north most of the time, who maybe haven't even stepped foot on the property or haven't been there in decades. And so when they realize that they can profit off of this land, they can sell a piece of it. So one of the most pernicious ways that we see this playing out is with partition actions. This is a law that allows speculators to buy off the interest of just a single heir, more often a few heirs. And once they've bought into kind of this co-ownership, they can go to the court and ask for a sale of the entire property. And they usually ask for that sale with this economic argument that the land can't be divided up and that it's much more valuable as a whole than in pieces, and they generally win. And what ends up happening is the people who live on the land or have the closest ties to the land have almost no way to protect their property. They have very few rights in most states. There is some reform that's been spreading across the South, but North Carolina has been a holdout and has refused to reform the system, even though it's been brought to the attention of the legislature many times since 2009. So with Melvin and LaCurtis's case, they had a distant uncle who lived in New Jersey, and he clearly saw a way that he was able to divide up the land and to carve out a piece for himself with an obscure law called Torrens. Torrens is an arcane law that really only exists in fewer than a dozen states, and North Carolina is still one of them. And all he really had to do was hire a lawyer, who the court then appointed, and then pay that lawyer, and to provide reasoning that he possessed the property through tenants, he said, who had rented the land from him, or had operated a club that he had built on the shore. And the family just didn't really understand what was happening at the time and didn't understand that they were in the process of losing their land. And as a result, they missed the statute of limitations to appeal to Torrens, and they have lived fighting that for the past 40 years.
And the brothers have been fighting it and fighting it so much so they refused to leave their land and were charged with civil contempt, and then they spent 8 years in jail.
It's unbelievable, right?
So how was the local community affected by this happening and the brothers kind of putting their lives on the line to protect this land?
In a lot of ways, when the brothers went to jail, I think many members of the family saw it as a sacrifice for them, that they were risking their liberty to hold on to this historic property, and not just historic property, but really the source of their income and their wealth and their well-being, and also just the kind of the home base for an entire family that is spread across the country. Once they went to jail, though, the land that was then owned by a real estate investment firm, they couldn't access it. And that meant that a lot of the men who Melvin had taught to work on the water couldn't shrimp anymore and couldn't go crabbing. They couldn't feed their community. They also couldn't bring in the same kind of income that they did before. So one of their cousins had to take a job at Best Buy and sell his trawler, and he made $11.50 an hour, and he just couldn't live in Merriman anymore, and he ended up moving to Newport, North Carolina. And Melvin and LaCurtis' brother, Billy, took work fixing roofs, but he very quickly defaulted on his mortgage on Silver Dollar Road and had to move out. And so the devastation was certainly in money, but it was also in this kind of sense of place and family that they began to unravel.
So this conversation has really come to the fore in public consciousness through the hearings last month in the House of Representatives about the racial wealth gap and how the legacy of slavery contributes to this. What is the link between the trends that you're reporting on here and the racial wealth gap?
I mean, this is a major contributor to the racial wealth gap. A group of statisticians and economists recently calculated that lost land for African Americans has amounted to hundreds of billions of dollars in lost wealth. And what we're seeing is that the wealth gap is huge and growing, right? The median black family has about a tenth the wealth of a white one. And what I was hoping that this article would convey is this particular way in which the legacy of Jim Crow has lived on and we have turned a blind eye. I mean, this is a problem that very few people talk about, but it is enormous. And what we are continuing to see are laws that are stacked against heirs property owners and heirs property owners who are losing land at record rates. I mean, I saw some unbelievable court records, you know, families that lost their land to a partition sale that was started by PCS Phosphate, the largest phosphate mine in North Carolina. And they had testified that their ancestors had been enslaved on that property and that they had a family cemetery they didn't want to lose. And so it's not just wealth, right? It is also a sense of heritage and a disregard for that.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to talk about solutions. Is there anything that can be done to remedy this problem? What can an heir's property holder do to protect their family's property?
So there are two questions there, I think. One is for heirs property owners and one is for regular citizens. So for heirs property owners, they should write a will. They can make family trees and start to track down every single living descendant since the last deed holder. And they can also talk to lawyers about clearing their title and also consolidating ownership, like in an LLC. Those are some of the first steps that families should be thinking about. And then I think from a legislative perspective, there are experts who have started to put forth reforms. One of the biggest is the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act. And this is an act that expands the rights of heirs in partition action. So it gives them the rights to buy land first if someone is petitioning to sell it. And it also mandates that courts think not only about the economic value of land, but also how a family would be affected by losing it, like what an eviction might mean. So that's one. And then the other are transfer on death deeds. So this is a statute that allows family owners and heirs property owners to register in the deeds office how land is being passed down, and it allows them to a cheaper and easier process for clearing up who is the legal owner of the land.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Lizzie Presser is a reporter at ProPublica. Her recent piece on the Reels brothers is featured in ProPublica and The New Yorker. And there'll be a documentary on the topic that comes out this winter. Lizzie, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Man Knot: Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood.
It's not every day that you come across an extraordinary, unknown work by one of the nation's greatest writers. That's the first line of an article in the latest issue of Smithsonian Magazine. The great American writer is Langston Hughes. And the man who came across the extraordinary, unknown work is Stephen Holscher. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you very much.
Langston Hughes is one of the most celebrated poets of the Harlem Renaissance. He died more than 50 years ago. So tell us where you found this work that had not been seen in decades.
Well, I work at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin, and I was working on a project that I thought was not necessarily related to Langston Hughes in the papers of an investigative journalist named John L. Spivak. And it was in the middle of working with the Spivak papers that I came across this manuscript that had a title to it, and it had Langston Hughes's name on it, so I knew who it was. But otherwise, there was no reference to it anywhere. Now I understand very well that it's not random whatsoever, but that's not how it first seemed to me.
Unlike many of Langston Hughes's most famous works, this is not a poem, it's an essay, and it describes a journey through the rural South that Hughes took with a friend. You deduce that this friend was actually Zora Neale Hurston, another legendary writer of the era. What were they doing on this journey?
They met up about halfway through the journey for Hughes. He was traveling through the American South, and he wanted to learn more about the American South. So he was on a train and hopping through Louisiana, the Mississippi. He gets off the train in Alabama, and who was there on the street but his friend Zora Neale Hurston. And they traveled a lot in Alabama and then over through Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and headed back to New York City. He was not from the South. The South was very important in his literary imagination, and so it was important for him to learn about it.
So this essay that you found is not long, and the focus is a teenager they met who had escaped a chain gang. Will you read a paragraph from this? The paragraph is after they've agreed to give him a ride in their car.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Gradually, before the lights of Savannah came in sight, in answer to our many questions, he told us his story. Picked up for fighting, prison, the chain gang. But not a bad chain gang, he said. They didn't beat you much in this one. Only once the guard had knocked two teeth out. That was all.
Give us some context for this. Why was it important for Langston Hughes to write about it?
This was a sight that travelers like Hughes and Hurston would have seen on the roads of Georgia. Mostly black men working on providing the infrastructure for cars such as theirs that traveled on. It was also a system of brutal incarceration that Hughes recognized immediately. It was no pure luck that most all of the workers were black. And Hughes understood very clearly that this was a form of racial oppression.
One of the strange, surprising details of this story is that it was published in Russian. Explain why.
Well, that was one of the amazing parts about this story. I really had no idea what the essay was. It was not published in any of Spivak's work that I could find. But it was only in reading deep into the archive that I found letters between Spivak and an American journalist living in Russia who thought that Spivak's book that came out in 1932 would be of interest to Soviet readers. And so he wrote to Spivak saying, well, you know what? Langston Hughes is in town. What if we ask if he would write the foreword to this book and we publish it in Russian? And that was sort of the light bulb moment when I figured out how all this fit together. So the book was eventually published in Russian in the Soviet Union, and Hughes wrote the foreword to it.
Do you think this essay is still relevant today?
Certainly the issue of mass incarceration and its relation to racism, which is at the core of his essay, unfortunately remains with us. There are so many historical actors out there that we just don't know their names, that we don't know their stories, and Hughes has provided us a window into one of those stories.
Stephen Holscher is an American Studies professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and he uncovered the lost Langston Hughes essay, Forward from Life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, police beating up on people.
Back up, right here. Back up and get on that step, okay? Back up.
All he did was break up a fight. And this is what happens for breaking up a fight.
This is a disgrace. There's a test in this city, and we intend to keep the pressure on. Think about that.
Let's continue to show this nation who we are. Continue to show this country who we are.
This is All Things Considered on WNYC. I'm Jamie Floyd. 5 years ago this week, Eric Garner died on Staten Island, his death triggering protests nationwide.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
New York City's medical examiner said it was a homicide caused by a police officer who choked Garner with enough force to trigger a fatal asthma attack. But no one has ever been prosecuted in connection with Garner's death. And as far as we know, there's still no outcome in the disciplinary hearing for Daniel Pantaleo, the officer at the center of the case. Today, in the next installment of The Docket, our series that uses real cases to examine the justice system, we look back at the Eric Garner case, the ways in which we police communities of color, and the persistent use of the chokehold.
It's a law enforcement technique where the police put extreme pressure on your neck to prevent blood and oxygen from reaching your brain.
Paul Butler is a former federal prosecutor turned constitutional law professor.
The cops used this technique, which they call a lateral vascular neck restraint, to force you to do what they say. But you can't do what they say because you cannot breathe. Because so many people have died after being placed in chokeholds, many police departments ban them, including the New York Police Department. But that doesn't stop some officers from using them anyway.
Hadn't the NYPD told its officers long before Eric Garner died that the chokehold was not a proper use of force?
Absolutely. But that regulation is like something in an employee handbook that doesn't have the force of civil or criminal law, which is one reason why Officer Pantaleo remains a member of the NYPD 5 years after the death of Eric Garner.
Now, as you use the word in your book, chokehold, policing black men, that word refers not only to the literal mechanism for police use of force. For you, it's a much larger metaphor. How so?
The chokehold is a way of visualizing how the law works for many Americans. In my book, Chokehold, I focus on African-American men. A lot of people have anxiety and fear about black men, and the law responds to that anxiety by giving police the power to control and regulate us as they wish. So when we think about some of these cases of police violence, it's easy to think that the problem is bad apple cops. I don't think that's it. I think the system is actually working the way it's supposed to. So in the same month when we remember the 5th anniversary of the killing of Eric Garner, we also observe the 4th anniversary of Sandra Bland being found hung in a jail cell in Texas. And we remember the 6th anniversary of George Zimmerman being found not guilty of murdering Trayvon Martin. So this is the law at work, and the law is protecting people who commit violence against people of color.
You say this, Paul Butler, as a former federal prosecutor. You started out as a prosecutor in Washington, D.C. I'm guessing that most of the people on the other side of the courtroom, the people you were charging and prosecuting, were African American. What were you thinking then?
I wanted to be a prosecutor for two reasons. First, I grew up in a segregated neighborhood in the south side of Chicago where 911 was a joke in the famous Public Enemy song. The police often weren't there when you felt like you needed them, and I wanted to bring some of those resources to my community. The other reason is that growing up in Chicago as a young black man, I had so many unpleasant experiences with the cops, I can't even count them all. And so I went into the criminal legal process as an undercover brother. I was hoping that I could make a change from inside.
What changed your mind?
Well, a couple of things. One was kind of a evolving recognition of the racial work that I was doing as a prosecutor. If you go to criminal court in D.C. where I prosecuted cases, you would think that white people don't commit crimes. White people were about 40% of the city's population. They were utterly absent from the criminal court. No matter what the percentage of the white population of the city, you're going to see mainly African-American and Latinx people in criminal court. The other big dramatic thing that happened while I was a prosecutor, I got arrested and prosecuted for a crime that I didn't commit. It was a silly little dispute about a parking space. My neighbor thought it belonged to her. It actually belonged to me, and she worked for the police. And so she called them and said that I pushed her, and they just rolled up on me one morning when I was outside and arrested me. Didn't ask any questions at all. People say, did you tell them that you were a prosecutor? I certainly did when they put those handcuffs on me. The cop said, so if you're a prosecutor, you probably already know this. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against me. All that cop saw was a young black man and what he was trained to do when there was any allegation against a young black man, without asking questions, is to put him in handcuffs and take him to the station. And things worked out fine for me because I had legal skills. I went to trial in a courtroom where I had literally prosecuted people. Sometimes my defense attorney friends, they get mad that it took this personal situation to make me understand the ravages of the criminal legal process. And I regret that it did. But what I said is that being prosecuted, being arrested for a crime I didn't commit, it made a black man out of me.
Let's talk, though, about the systemic change that we want to see in the world. What can we do to achieve a measure of justice? I'm going to ask you to spell it out for us. What does that look like, especially in the Trump era?
So I think direct action means not letting this horrible moment in American history limit our ambitions or prevent us from agitating for the things that we really need. Because it's not like everything was great before Trump was elected. Black people still encounter discrimination in every single market that we enter, whether it's trying to get a taxi cab or trying to get a mortgage. That was true before Donald Trump. And unless we agitate for the kind of transformation, it's going to be true after Donald Trump leaves office. We didn't talk about reforming slavery. We talked about abolishing it. We didn't talk about reforming the old Jim Crow. We talked about abolishing it. And so I don't think we should think about reforming the new Jim Crow. I think we have to think about abolition.
Paul Butler is a professor at Georgetown Law School and the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Professor Butler, thank you so very much.
Great to be here.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 20, 2019, so I have been told. Professor Butler, Georgetown University in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., he said that this incident, having what I suspect a white woman, race soldier, make a false report to the police that he pushed her and they came out to arrest him. He said that being arrested and prosecuted for assaulting this white woman made a black man out of me. What a sentence. I would have had to ask, what does that mean exactly? Should prompt a lot of questions. What does that even say about being a black male in a system of white supremacy, that incident, being falsely accused, arrested, prosecuted, that's the black male experience, system of racism, white supremacy? The other question it prompted, if this incident made you, wait a minute, let me say it how he said, made a black man out of me, that's what Professor Butler said. If that's true, then what were you prior to this incident? If he does any lectures, maybe we'll see if we can get him as a guest on the program. If anybody hears this broadcast and you're at a book signing or an event where he's present, those would be a couple questions to ask. Definitely. What were you before this incident, if this incident made a black man out of you? And then what does that mean exactly? Anywho, compensatory call-in. If you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, the number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. I have griped about the weather here in Seattle. I think for the decade that I have been on the air with the Cows, I don't think I have said Seattle has spectacular weather. They do not. However, the sun did come out today. It was lovely. It's been like 73 degrees. I am aware that there is a so-called heat wave in much of the United States. That is not here in Washington State. It has barely, really, until yesterday and today, it has not really been above 70 degrees very frequently this month. So the heat wave is not here. Anyway, it was beautiful today. It's still lovely now as I'm gazing out and looking at, you know, all of the clear blue sky of Seattle. It's supposed to be even a little bit warmer tomorrow. And on Monday, it is supposed to be 80 degrees. I don't even remember the last time that it was above 80 degrees here in Seattle. We are doing yoga in the park. I am teaching Monday afternoon, 1 to 4. I had some folks email and say, hey, we are Cows listeners and we live in the area and are down for yoga. Sent them out the information. If you live in the area and or are visiting and would like to do yoga in the park Monday afternoon, it is supposed to specifically appeal to non-white people. It's written on the flyer as such. When I taught 2 weeks ago, when I taught, as I said, I only had one student that was not black. Everybody that I taught was black, and there were lots and lots of black children, non-white children who were there. It's part of some sort of summer camp type program to encourage young people to exercise and all that. We'll be down for that too. But so they will probably be, when I say young, these are like under 10 children. So they'll probably be there for the first hour. If you have younger children, you want to bring them out, have them do some yoga with a lot of other black children. Come out, hang out at 1 o'clock. If you want to come a little later, there should be older black people, when I say older than 10, who are coming to hang out and do some yoga. We had older people and younger people, when I say younger, like around 10, 12 years old, practicing with older people over 18, all practice together. It was grand, not too strenuous, but you'll definitely feel it in your body. Should be great. It is free. You can bring a mat if you have one, if you want to, but mats will be provided. But it is 1 to 4 this Monday right here in Seattle. If you send me an email, I can get you all of the information if you would like to come out and do yoga with Gus T. Next, let's see. So many interesting things to report from this week. Let's see. The report on the theft of black property. We've done so many broadcasts. We just finished in the book club, James Lowen's book on Sundown Towns, Theft of Black Property. We've had so many guests on before. Andrew Carl, his book, The Land Was Ours, N.D.B. Connolly. He was on the program specifically to talk about white supremacy and land theft in the state of Florida. But we numerous programs over the years specifically on that subject. And N.D.B. Connolly specifically, he said that whites have gotten better at stealing black-owned property over the years. I thought it was significant that in that report from North Carolina Public Radio, they said the USDA says that the lack of wills, high number of black people not having wills, that is a huge part, maybe the biggest part, of why so many black people are losing their property. I would contend if we are in a system of racism, white supremacy, that would be the number one reason that black people are losing property and every aspect of that. If it's black people not having wills, I'm pretty certain that there is a history of white lawyers practicing racism, white supremacy, either with the fees, not doing what they said in the will, taking advantage of illiterate or poorly educated, deliberately miseducated black people. I'm sure there's a long history of that. In fact, if my memory is not too bad, I could have sworn I included an audio segment that talked about the lack of what they call diversity, Negroes, in the legal industry, and what can we do to fix that so that it's not just white people as prosecutors and attorneys. I could have sworn I just heard a report on that. Anyway, whether it's that contributing why the attorneys, in terms of why black people do not have wills, if it's the refusal to have legislation and to take corrective action to see that, oh, this is a problem, we should step in and do something about this. She said, the reporters, I believe they said that North Carolina and other states, they have been hesitant, unwilling to make these sort of changes, to say, oh, man, this is a big part of why black people are losing property. We should do something about this. Man, we got other problems. Pig crap everywhere. We got other problems. I thought that was important, but significant, I guess, if we have folks who are listening, perhaps making sure that you do have a will. Maybe that's something that can be included in terms of counter-racism, easy ways to do it so that it's cost-effective, efficient. It does seem like that generates problems in a variety of ways, whether it's conflict with other black people. It seemed like they had a variety of different strategies how they go about doing this. They go to one family member and offer them a little bit of cash. Hey, sell your property, boom, boom, boom. Having a will might minimize some of those opportunities for white people to come and cause conflict between other black people. If folks have any tips, I think retired firefighter talked about working on a will not that long ago. I guess if we have any listeners who have tips, counter-racist suggestions to make that process a little easier or maybe even encouragement. Maybe that's something that folks kind of hesitate about doing. If folks have any encouragement as to why they think that would be helpful and to maybe minimize problems, as were discussed in that clip, please share. Let's see, next. If we have black educators listening to the broadcast, I know we have for years, on the workplace racism segment yesterday, we had a caller who requested help formulating a code. He's starting a new job at a school, middle and high schoolers, and he wanted help figuring out the best way to conduct himself with both white and non-white teachers, parents, and students. And a number of folks did write in. We had some people who called in and just, you know, shared this directly. We had other folks who wrote in. If we have folks who are listening now, educators, and you have, I guess, your own code for dealing with white and or non-white teachers, parents, students, please share. That would help at least one victim of white supremacy piece together a new code for a new plantation. Let's see. Next. The I forgot to include, or I can't say I forgot, you can't play everything every week. There were a number of audio segments this week that I did not include. They're having a summer festival up in Canada that I wanted to talk about, and the officers in Chicago related to the Laquan McDonald killing. They fired, reportedly, four officers for their misconduct in that case, lying. You talk about that being the number one weapon of white supremacy. Racism is deception, and them firing these four officers. Not that that's anything I would celebrate. I think there's tremendous information, evidence that many of these enforcement officials generally are not fired. They are transferred. I've seen too many instances. Even if you do have a firing, sometimes you have to wait a year, and these officers will appeal, and that decision will be overturned, and then they'll get back pay for the time that they were allegedly terminated, and then they'll get their job back. I've seen that happen. That happened down in Louisiana with Hurricane Katrina and some of the race soldier terrorism that occurred there. Nothing to celebrate, and you still have Laquan McDonald is still dead. So, you know. Anywho, let's see, continuing. This is our compensatory call-in. I do request regularly that we are mindful with our words. Not using metaphors is a big part of that. There were a number of metaphors incorporated during the sound clips. We got the ever-popular elephant in the room. Interesting how that metaphor is regularly invoked. When people talk about white supremacy, racism, elephant in the room. In fact, I can't even really think of too many times when that metaphor is used for something not related to racism, white supremacy. If folks can think of examples when that metaphor is invoked and they're not talking about racism, feel free to share. Let's see some of the other ones. When they had the myriad of folks who were being interviewed regarding President Donald J. Trump's social media activity and accusations of racism, they said of the non-white female congresswomen, they said, don't throw rocks if you live in a glass house. That's what this situation, that's the conclusion that he came to using that metaphor. Thought that was interesting. Let's see. They had a few others. I tried to write down as many of them as I could, but they had a number of these little cute phrases that were invoked throughout. Incidentally, even within that sound clip, I think that's the one where you got the metaphor about not throwing rocks. NPR went to interview Trump supporters who said, regardless of the accusations and people calling him racist, we still support him. They went to a gun range in Montana. I am sure there are Trump supporters in many places. I'm sure they could have went to a Starbucks in Montana. They could have went to a library. They could have went to a community college, grocery store, lots of places that they could have went. Bus stop, who knows? I've been to Montana briefly. They got, I think, everything I just mentioned and additional sites that would have been fine. No, they went to the blacksmith gun range. I thought that was extraordinarily significant because I've heard them talk politics many, many times. It's election season. I've heard them talk about black voters and issues related to black people. When does an issue pop up where they're, you know, we're talking about President Trump and we're going to the gun range to interview a number of black people to get their thoughts on this issue? Like, that is totally unrelated to guns, unless I missed something. That is totally unrelated to guns, gun laws. This is not about a mass shooting or anything like that. When does that happen? I thought that was communicating just an extraordinary message. I mean, even if it's our Trump supporters, are we automatically connect them with guns, shooting, violence? Is that what we're automatically supposed to connect them to? I thought it was hugely significant. If other folks have thoughts on that, feel free to share. With all of that said, words are extremely important. This broadcast, I ask if we not use metaphors, speak directly to what it is that we would like to convey. It's my view, racists they deliberately invoke these kind of metaphors to not be clear, to give a response that can be interpreted in a number of different ways. In my view, that is one means of causing confusion deliberately, deception deliberately. Not in my view, racist whites, they do this thing, this sort of behavior on a regular basis. They'll also do comparison and contrast. They'll take two separate entities and say, oh, yeah, these are exactly the same. They're equivalent. Darn near talking about twins. They'll say this type of thing on a regular basis when often the two things being compared or contrasted are not identical at all. We victims of white supremacy have been subject to this misconduct for centuries, myself included. And many of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes there's subjects where we just have not come to a conclusion. That is not a problem. Or sometimes we just don't have all the information. We're lacking logic to accurately articulate what we want to say or accurately articulate our view. And we'll substitute logic for a metaphor or a comparison of some sort. And frequently, this just contributes to a lot more confusion. If we could make an effort to be direct, specific to what it is we want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Let's see. I will save the rest of my comments once we get a little bit further into the broadcast. Again, the yoga retreat in Florida, if you would like to be included to get information, all of the details should be forthcoming within about 2-3 days with all of the information. As I said, this will be our first time planning correctly for a retreat where it's supposed to be planned like 6 months to a year in advance to give people ample opportunity to plan, schedule, make sure that they don't have any conflicts. Our tentative dates are December 27 to January 1, end of the year, celebrating the beginning of 2020, so-called. If folks have any input, workshops they would like to see, activities that could be carried out at the retreat, if they think there's a major problem with those dates or something that could be done that would maybe make it easier for folks to participate, if they think there's a major scheduling conflict, the holidays might be too hectic for those specific dates, even with, 5.5 months of advance. No, really more than that, because we've been talking about this for a while, but even with good notice, feel free. It's early enough. You can drop an email and we can, make tweaks, make adjustments if that would be helpful for folks to be able to come participate, plant-based meals, do some yoga, plan out constructive activities for the coming year, and constructive exchange of views on counter-racist topics. Looking forward to it and to being in the sunshine. I said we didn't, or at least I did not get the heat wave and did not feel like a whole lot of sunshine was available here for this Seattle summer. So that would be kind of compensating being able to go down to Florida for December when I know it will definitely not be sunny and warm here, nor in many other places. We can get down to Florida, hopefully even get outside, do some water time. Great counter-racist activity for the middle of the winter. Before we hit our callers, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have supported for a decade plus and kept the cows on the air. We also have Cash App now. You can hit cash.app/$thecows. Also have our wish list at Amazon.com listed under Gus T. Renegade. Again, tremendous appreciation to all of the listeners, investors who have kept us broadcasting for over 10 years. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Speaking of time and energy, I'll make sure I get in one more comment before we get to the callers. I was listening to NPR yesterday morning. Try to be informed. Dr. Welsing encouraged us be informed locally, nationally, globally. I'm listening to the news. They have a report on this new documentary that was nominated for an Academy Award. We had the professor Charles Stewart on the broadcast just a few weeks back, second time on the program. And I told him, I've said it for years, if there are films, if it features a lot of black people, I generally don't want to see it. I feel that white supremacists in entertainment really intensify the trashiness and racist content if it's a lot of black people in a film or a project. That's my conclusion after, you know, an unhealthy number of years watching, binging on a lot of television. And so I'm just not interested. Any of the content, Belly, Empire, Black Panther, Get Out, even though that was not a predominantly black cast, but anything like that, anything that is, you know, this has got a lot of black people in it, or this is something that is being marketed to black people, I generally, you know, I run fast. I get out. I do what they say. So they say this documentary, Hale County, Hale, H-A-L-E, County, this morning, this evening. They say it's nominated for an Academy Award. It's spectacular. You know, you got to check it out. It's wonderful. So I hear, okay, maybe I'll check it out. Now I have, you know, I'm immediately thinking, generally, anything that's nominated for an Academy Award, I think The Help, Driving Miss Daisy. That's what I think. Like, oh, man, this is really going to be something that I don't want to see. Precious. It's going to make me nauseous. I would say, we'll try. My pal, I just said, thankfully, we watched Black Mirror days before she got a brand new sparkling television. So I said, hey, we can watch Hale County this morning, this evening on your brand new sparkly television. She said, this isn't going to be like that Black Mirror, is it? I said, I don't know. Like, let's watch the trailer. We tried to watch the trailer, and it wouldn't play. And we both said, maybe that's an omen that we shouldn't watch this. And said, we'll try. We will be brave. We'll go ahead and give it a try. So we watched. It was indeed an omen. We should have picked something else and still have not been able to watch something cool on the new sparkly television. In fact, she compared it immediately to the Black Mirror episode that we recently discussed this week on the program, Striking Vipers, where just the presentation of black people, a presentation of black people doing wild things and being in a disheveled state. I think the term, my terminology, I think is Negro trauma drama. That's what it seemed to show to me. Just there didn't seem to be a unifying theme. It was just showing black people doing different things, victims of racism. But I remember they had one scene where it was a black mother, and she was talking about her son or her child resenting her, and how she and the child's father were in conflict, and it got so bad that her own mother took the child until she could get her situation, improve her situation. And so this took, I think, until her child was about 12. And I mean, it was just conflict all as a result of the system of white supremacy. But I mean, seeing this type of content, and there was quite a bit of this sort of content there, and black people playing basketball, it reminded me of like The Hate U Give. Like, this racists are very, very comfortable and, in my view, enjoy this type of depiction of black people struggling down and out, having a tough time in Alabama, doing the limited number of things that we allow black people to do, being in conflict with each other, being arrested and harassed by the police. They had a few mandatory scenes of that, police coming over and pulling over some black people and fussing at them about this, that, and the other. I mean, seen that before many, many times, nothing to celebrate. Again, reading is more important than watching television. Very rarely do I find many things on the screen that are worthy of our time and energy if there is, in fact, a system of white supremacy. Number again is 605-313-5166. 6-4, be code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, if we have Black educators, if you have a code around how you conduct yourself with white and or non-white teachers, parents, students, please share. If you have other thoughts, comments on the audio segments and such that we heard this week and or other counter-racist suggestions, comments you'd like to share, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. Good clips. The art, I thought that was important. I thought that would lead into, I guess there wasn't a clip about the ebony pictures having to be sold for the payoff debts, another tragic event. But when they were talking about the first young lady, Miss Savage, they called her a street urchin, then talked about her father. So either she's a street urchin or she's at home with her father. Make up your mind about who she was. That was confusing to me. And the fact that they called her a street urchin shouldn't be shocking. Well, I mean, that was kind of low. I thought that was disrespectful and low. But I wasn't there. And from what I heard, she wasn't quoted as saying that. She was quoted about her father. So she had a father in the home, or they were both homeless. No one said that. For educated, I was in education. For students, I tried to, don't let them hug you. Sometimes these students, they want to hug you. Don't do that. They come and hug you, and I'm sure sometimes, hopefully that person is taller. I'm sure, and sometimes, like, male students, not that it's sexual, but like, oh, yay, thanks so-and-so. I'm like, me too. Don't hug me, no, me. That's my phrase now. Don't go to sporting events and just say you don't want all. I appreciate all of you. All of you are wonderful students. I don't want to show any favoritism by going to any sporting events unless you happen to be the football coach or something. Don't go. Now you have to. They probably will make you. Well, not make you, but eventually you have to be join a student organization. You can help the Black students. People would think that was acceptable. There's a Black student club. That would be fine, I guess. You know, that would be kind of expected, I guess, of you. So, and be careful of that, because sometimes if you're, especially, I don't know if this is a male educator, there aren't a lot of you. So sometimes students may come to you with deep emotional problems. Be prepared to know where the psychologist's office is. Be prepared to know that and to help transfer them to that department and to that person. Because sometimes, especially, and I was taught in college, I would assume it would be worse in middle and elementary, in middle and high school, because they still legally have to go home and things like that. At least in college, they can break away. Usually they're 18, they don't necessarily have to go home. They know how to find a friend and stay at someone else's home. So be mindful of that. Do your job, be pleasant. You know, you can talk in the elevator. I wouldn't have too many deep conversations, things like that. And pretty much a lot of the stuff that's in Mr. Fuller's book, I would probably just at least start from there and merge that information with the actual code of conduct that you have. And not only the code of conduct, but also know the student bylaws, the things that they have to do, and their punishments for certain events. So sometimes you may have to exercise those and, you know, have judgment in those areas. Please stop watching TV. I can't take it. My heart hurts for you. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I don't know how much yoga you have to do to bounce back. Well, not bounce back, but to re-energize yourself or put yourself in a better mental state after watching those shows. I don't know if there's enough yoga. Hopefully there is for you. So just be careful of that. And if you do want to have TV or film discussions, I believe a lot of us have that. You can just volunteer and ask. Not me. I don't watch. I watch game shows. I can help you. Mostly game shows. But I'm sure there are enough people that watch TV and things like that that they may be in the discussion, and you just monitor the phones. That's all. Thank you.
That is true. I think enough people have watched television that they could hold it down. And I did. I think we did tap out officially on Hale County. We did not watch it to the end. I think both of us said we reached a saturation point. And paused and did not return. I will ask, I guess, really quick, though, with the sporting events, that's one that I think you can get a lot of peer pressure on. Like, what do you mean you're not going to be – you don't want to show favoritism? You're supposed to show favoritism. You're supposed to support your home team. What happens if they say, what do you mean? That's nonsense. You're supposed to be there to support the school. These are our students.
Like I said, I worked at a college, so I didn't have that many problems. I had one student, she was on the soccer team, but I explained it to her. But we got along very well, and she understood, and we talked outside of class about other things. So I didn't have that problem, because I was in college. And sometimes it's just like me being a female. I could say, well, I'm out late at night, things like that. Or you could say things like that depending on the area. If you have a family, you have a family. You can't do everything. And even if you don't have kids and stuff, you have parents and stuff, that is a good excuse. Almost everyone has a family. You know, you have to just say you have to, you know, I call my mom. I don't know, call your mom or something, and we talk, you know, because I know a lot of schools have Friday night football. I know this is the time we talk during the week to go over certain things. You know, my relationship with my mother is really important, what I'm going to do. I'm going to call my mother. Oh, it's FaceTime. No, no, no. I don't know. Do whatever you have to do. I would just say try not. I know it seems mean. Now, if you go to all of them you have all the time, go to all of them or go to none of them. That's just me. Go to all of them or go to none of them.
Much obliged. I can't see that being... I could see if you make an exception or you do something and you go to one event, you go to a football game or a basketball game, invariably that's, oh, wait a minute, our softball game and our volleyball, that I don't do any of it. That's excellent with the family. Or anything else can come up, I think, with a variety of reasons to justify why you will not be able to be present for those activities. Time and energy is important. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, Chell, have comments, questions to share, suggestions. Trying to get... Other folks, give me a second. All right. Other folks who dialed in with the hand up, y'all have comments.
Hello, Gus.
Greetings, B in Toronto.
How are you today? I'm sorry, I'm just on the Bluetooth here. Can you hear me okay?
Your volume is a little low. I guess if you could get either closer to the microphone or speak up, either or.
Is this a bit better?
Oh, yeah, much louder, much better.
Okay, great. I took it off of Bluetooth. I'm pretty sure that things are still right poorly, but I think I have a solution to helping with keeping the... with keeping on course with ending white supremacy. I've been thinking a lot about this in fighting against white supremacy. It's sometimes for me hard to try and envision what it would be like if it was non-existent, and it was completely eliminated. So one of the solutions that I would recommend is for callers and listeners, myself, yourself, to start envisioning what white supremacy would be like if it was completely eliminated. I do apologize if it does sound redundant if you are already doing this or if callers or listeners are already doing this. I just find that it helps reignite and keeps me on course of on my code in terms of helping me to realize that without white supremacy, life expectancy could increase. The mistreatment would be greatly reduced. It wouldn't be completely eliminated, but greatly reduced because it's no longer there. Start envisioning what it would be like to be a universal man, universal woman, as Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. Has described, where there's actual justice. And that would help with keeping that motivation going. In terms of additional goals for the educator, one of the things that I would suggest is to have a goal. Does the educator intend on staying as a teacher, or do they intend on becoming a principal, or perhaps finding a niche as in special education, or in a complex needs team within the school board, if there is a complex needs team? I know that in Ontario, the schools, they do have different facets within the school board. So once in, just to definitely ask questions and find out what other avenues within the school board they can look into. That's about it. I'll leave the line. Thank you so much for your platform.
Love it. Be in Toronto. That is an outstanding suggestion in terms of, you know, what is the vision here? Are we trying to be a principal or moving up? Like, what is your career path? What are we thinking here in terms of that also will influence how you conduct yourselves, what you're saying, what you're doing, not saying, not doing. Also, I thought our previous female call saying no to hugs. Excellent. In the classroom, we think about that for other work environments. I think that is especially important because I think that can be an environment where there can be a lot of touching sometimes. And with all the different lawsuits and things happening to teachers and all that, I think that might be a really excellent piece of codification to include as well. No hugging of students and no hugs. Thank you kindly, Bobby, Lisa. It's great work. No hugs. Thank you. But great commentary from be in Toronto as well. Even before I get to other folks who dialed in with a hand up, I will say, I think retired firefighter commented previously about watching movies, and he said he'll, you know, rewind and ask questions and that sort of thing. I have done that myself, and people generally will get angry. You talk about you will be booted out sometimes for that sort of conduct, so what I will try to do is maybe ask one question during the movie, make sure it's a good one, or give them one thing to pay attention to before the movie. If it's something that I've already seen, I'm familiar with, I'll give them one thing to pay attention to. I watched Stranger Things on Netflix. I'd never seen it before. We watched one episode with people who are huge fans of the show. Like, they are waiting for the third season to come out so they could watch. So we go to watch. I've just heard bits and pieces about this, but, you know, reading is more important than watching television. So we go to watch the one episode, and the older character is upset. he's fussing. His daughter has a black male friend. It's a group. It's not like this is a date thing. It's a big group of people. She just happens to be, they are there and chatting, but it's a lot of folks who are there and chatting in big kid activity. So her white father comes in and he grabs this black child and is yelling at him, "Didn't I tell you to stay away from my daughter?" And so he's fussing. This is a big theme of the episode. And so I wait, you know, after this has gone on for a while, this fussing, him fussing about her. I think her older white brother comes as well and fusses, you know, "Didn't I tell you to stay away from her?" So one of the people that I'm with, I ask, "Hey, you know, what's the problem? Why do they not want Lewis Sinclair is the black boy's name. Why do they not want Lewis around the daughter?" And she says, "Oh, I think her dad is racist." And I'm flabbergasted because it's never that direct. That's never just the plot of it. It'll always be some other excuse. You know, he's got bad clothes or he flunks or he's a crackhead or something. But she says, "Oh, I think the dad is racist." I said, "Whoa, okay." So I waited about 5 minutes. I'm one other person who's watching with us. I said, "Why? Do you know why the dad doesn't want this little black fellow with his daughter?" And she says, "Oh, I think it's because he's black." Thank you. I'm not asking any more questions. Let's proceed. Stranger Things. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we've missed you totally, if you have commentary, suggestions, questions.
Can I be heard? Can I be heard?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, we can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay, Gus must have dropped off. Either way, man, I have Imhan Dici on the line with me. I don't know if he has any reports from Africa, and I could go after him.
Well, somebody can say something. We're listening.
Or maybe Imhan Dici dropped. I'm sorry. I did want to say this. They have a rapper. Sorry, the siren outside. It's hot. They have a rapper named ASAP Rocky. He's a rapper / model. He does fashion. He dresses very effeminately. He comes from Harlem, the Polo Ground Project. If you go to the project and get in the elevator, you see a button for the 30th floor. So he's a real big project, you know. Each building has about 1,200 residents in the building. So either way, he goes to Sweden, and he gets into some type of altercation with some white boys. Him and a friend of his end up beating the guy up, and he gets arrested by the Swedish police. And they've been holding him for some time. Now, me personally, when he came out about 2014 or so, after signing a record deal or a modeling contract, he moved out of the project, Mike Brown gets shot. And when he was asked about Mike Brown, he says, "I can't relate. I live in Soho in Beverly Hills. I do modeling and rapping. I can't relate to that stuff. Don't ask me questions about, you know, police shootings and stuff like that." So I personally, I don't have any empathy for this dude in his present situation. However, he did somehow get Trump to come out and try to, you know, get him out of this situation. And I don't know if it's going to work for him. As for Trump himself, I don't have any problem with the statements he made regarding the congresswomen. Well, all but one. You know, you had a Palestinian woman, and only less than 1% of the U.S. population is Palestinian. Who is she representing? You got a Somalian who's married to her brother. And you got a Puerto Rican. And I believe Trump was throwing paper towels at them a couple of months ago. So I really don't have any problems with what he said. They all have a country they could go back to. You know what I'm saying? The Smithsonian themselves is one of the largest seas of American history of the American people. I want people to look up this guy named Ales Hrdlicka, Aleshrdlicka. He founded and became the first curator of physical anthropology at the Smithsonian Institute back in 1903. He set up the Yaqua Indians, who look black like us, had them killed by the United States military. He removed flesh from their skulls as part of his studies, his anthropology studies. He then took those skulls and brought them to the New York American Museum of Natural History, which is right here in Manhattan. And they're still on display to this day. He created out of thin air the widely accepted white supremacist science called the theory of human colonialization of the American continent from East Asia, which he claimed happened 3,000 years ago. Today, that's called the Bering Strait theory. It has morphed, and now it's 10,000 years ago, and it keeps changing and increasing because it's not real. But this is the person that created that theory. Anytime they talk about some Asian people walked over the Bering Strait, it's a lie. This guy made it up. I heard some interesting things during an eclipse. I heard whiteness. Please, if you haven't, if you want a better understanding on how white people are deceiving and confusing us, look into a field of academia known as whiteness studies. This is where white privilege comes from and all these concepts that Tim Wise and all of these people use. Also, I heard logic games is a field of academia known as systems theory. It's a huge part of systems theory is known as game theory. All systems operate off of systems theory, including the system of white supremacy. Game theory is the field of math and science that applies to social interaction. A game is any interaction between multiple people in which person's payoff is affected by the decision made by others. Think white supremacy, how they have us. Each decision we make affects another black person. I also heard about surveillance in the clip. Please look into a book. It's by Shoshana Zuboff called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for Human Future at a New Frontier of Power. Once again, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. The last time they changed the system of how whites conduct the global business of white supremacy, it went from mercantilism or commercialization to market capitalism or industrialization, and now they're switching it from industrialization to this surveillance capitalism. And it's very important that we we prepare for it, because the last time they switched it, it took us a century to adjust, and we still haven't adjusted completely to the switch. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Gus is back. Really stunning tech issues. Everything kind of froze. But I should be back. Thank you for your patience. And folks already know the procedure. They just continued right along. Counter racist code. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, suggestions, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, the Black African. Yes, sir.
I guess I've been listening to the archives for a couple of weeks, and I guess the clip about Dr. King, I thought there was an interesting metaphor used in that. The gentleman, he said that when they were talking about, like, really, I guess, trying to find out a lot of information about Dr. King, especially concerning some of the accusations. He said that, like, that they should, that there's a day king and a night king. So I guess the day king is the Dr. King that that most people know. And then I guess the night king is, I guess, his the sexual, I guess, accusations. And then I thought it was very interesting. I think they said that the lady that was talking, she said that when he visited her, or it was sort of like hearsay, that he was giddy like a boy. I thought that was horrible. I guess from today, the metaphors that I heard that I thought were interesting, I heard that numbers don't really lie. But I think, you know, like statistics, it depends how you use it. And then I heard the lady, I guess she was called Indian. I'm not sure what that, if she's like an American Indian or like an Indian from India. I guess she had to apologize after attempting to talk truth. I think she said something like, conversations coming from a place of love. I guess it means now, I guess she will be more reluctant to tell the truth. And then the LSAT, I think that's really important. The LSAT clip that you played was really, really important because I took the GMAT, and those exams are really, really hard. Even white people that get like perfect scores on them, they'll talk about how difficult those were. It was very costly for me to, because I tried to do GMAT and I failed. Well, not necessarily failed, but I didn't get the score that I wanted. And to get the score that I wanted, I had to go through this program, and it was like a lot. I can't remember how much, but it was at least like $2,000. It was a lot of money, and it was like rigorous, and the exams are very tricky. I think and an interesting term that I remember that came out of those classes that I heard was they described the people that wrote the exams as like problem makers or problem writers. So they're like experts in writing problems that confuse people. And then I guess the term that I heard that like white people stealing land was involuntary land loss. I mean, just like when we talk about like the global system, it's theft on such an incredible level. I thought that was a terrible term. I guess lastly, I don't know if, I guess to what Thomas was just talking about, I guess about the Native Americans whom, I don't know how to put, I guess they were, and with the Smithsonian, I guess they were, their artifacts were stolen and they were killed, and he said that they were black like us. I'm wondering, because I keep hearing this, and I'm not sure if there's somebody that knows more, or if there's a book, or if there's a guest that can come and talk about, I guess, because all the books that I've seen, like Native Americans, I mean, they're very dark, but I wouldn't say that they were black people. So, but I do know that I've seen that there are black people all over the planet that have, like, I guess, I don't want to say a metaphor, like curly hair or whatever, like, I don't know what term to use. And so I'm just wondering if that's the case here. And what did they look like? Did they have a specific look? Like, I'm just curious about it, and because I'm just not educated in that, and I'm not sure if that's something that somebody can help with, or if you could bring a guest on, because I think that would clarify a lot of confusion, especially for me. Thank you, Albany. Oh, last thing, if I have, I think Emma Hadisi was talking about how like Africans said that, well, some of the Africans in Ghana were saying that he was like a white person, like something of that sort. And I thought that was interesting because that's a metaphor that people from where I come, they use that, like a white person is like a benefactor. So sometimes they'll call you their white person, like, you're my white person if you are helping them out or if you have more money or something like that. So I thought that was interesting what he said. Thank you. I'll meet Milan.
Very interesting. Much obliged, the Black African. Greetings to Imhan DC as well. He was mentioned. Especially thank you for the information about the tests. I think that is important. And I think we've had a number of listeners who've talked about some of those different exams, especially as you're moving up in higher education, as they say, how they can be costly and tricky. I mean, whose job is that? Like, that's what I do best. Write things to confuse people, confound you, have you undecided about what to do. Like, wow, that's your job. Incredible. And as I said, I know we have other folks who've called in to talk about that before, every aspect of it, and having to fail and retake them and the training courses and all of that, and the seeming ease that other whites, they're able to get through without as many obstacles, it seems at times. Involuntary land loss, great focus on terms. I can't believe in a system of racism, white supremacy, that you would even have a term like that, that is so indirect and so inefficient. Like, really? Three words? Theft would be one. We could put it that way. Lots of other ways we could describe involuntary land loss. If folks have either suggestions for research material, potential guests with regards to Black people being the original indigenous folks that they are talking about, and specifically their hair texture, what they look like, et cetera. If folks have material to recommend as we go through, feel free. Let's try to get the folks we missed totally. And then we should have time if other folks, if you have comments, questions, research offerings, we'll have time to include that as well. Other folks we missed totally. If you have a hand up, Perosi.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Draptomania.
Greetings, Gus and callers. I just wanted to make two quick statements in regards to the clips. Very good clips, as usual. I thought it was very interesting. I'm not sure if he was, he's some type of politician, in the beginning that was speaking in regards to Trump's comments, about him making, racist comments towards the Black, congresswomen. And he made a statement that, Donald Trump, he was elected to build the wall. And I just thought that was pretty interesting, you know, being that we say that, you know, these politicians are elected for a reason and a purpose. And he just basically straight out said that he was elected. The purpose of his election was to build the wall. So I thought that was very telling. And I also thought it was very interesting how white male, white supremacist suspect, I would just say they're white supremacist. I wouldn't even say suspect, because the man who was defending President Trump, he had no qualms about anything that he was saying about the Black women. But I just think it's very interesting how they interview white men and asked them if statements towards other non-white people are racist or not, instead of going to the victims to see if the victims feel if those statements are racist. I just think that that's very interesting, and it's something that's a pattern that they often do. It's always predicated upon whether white supremacist suspects believe something is racist or not. And the next statement that I wanted to refer to was the racial wealth gap that divides black families. Its origins are in Jim Crow, white supremacist laws. And that's just another example of how white supremacy is the culprit of non-white black folks bickering and fighting with one another. They were describing in that clip how black families in North Carolina, that black family that was fighting. And, you know, it just goes along with the theme of this program, that you usually say that the most likely suspects or the ones that's most responsible for the problem, even in workplace racism, when, you know, I call in and I tell you about how there's another victim victimizing me or victimizing someone else. And it's always goes back to say, well, the most one that's most responsible is white supremacy. And this clip that you just played just validated that statement. And that's all I had to share. And thanks a lot for listening. Have a nice evening.
Much obliged, Draftomania. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, if folks have any suggestions around writing a will, suggestions why that's important, or any tips that would make that process a little less painful, that would be appreciated as well. That was a major component of that report on, involuntary land loss in North Carolina. Other folks that have dialed in with a hand up that we missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, everyone. I think there is some importance into writing a will. Well, having a will made, and I recently completed that process. It was an interest of mine for a while. I was just procrastinating to get it complete. I actually did one, a do-it-yourself one. But I later evaluated it and didn't think I did a very good job. And when I went to the bank and looked it over, I can see where not only there were some mistakes, also there are some things that I would wanted to change based on, you know, a couple of years of a change of thought of some sort of things that I would want to be arranged. You never know of the time that you would be of your death, or to be incapacitated to where you cannot make decisions. You're still alive, but you are incapacitated to where you cannot make decisions for yourself. And if you do not have plans for those two events, then there's probably going to be other people making those plans. Now, everything that I'm saying can be overruled by the global system of racism and white supremacy, but nevertheless, there is some situations to whereas they mean the racists are not really involved directly into all of their victims in that way to be able to just, you know, step in and state, well, no, I'm taking over with this decision. So it would be good to do it, you know, make those sort of plans. And also, even some of your most quote unquote closest members of your care group, you may find out during those particular periods of time that I thought I knew that person, and it becomes problems. You get reports on what I'm talking about with people who are quote unquote well known. I just read something recently to whereas Aretha Franklin's sons are fighting over her money or whatever. What do they call it? Estate. They're fighting over her estate. And that certainly is not unusual for a quote unquote well-known non-white person. And that's something, and it also happens even with people who are not notarized to that level. It happens. And you, it would be good to, in order to keep discontentment down, that you have some sort of already pre-planned arrangements of whatever is next to your name in terms of wealth or some sort of property or that sort of thing. Most of us don't have a whole lot of anything, but whatever that is, it can be, you know, organized. That's all. We're just talking about organization. That's primarily what it is. Other than that, I, as far as my report weekly, I did not attend the mentoring program today. What they are scheduled to do today was actually to go to something called an etiquette class. That's an annual thing with each class. We have a non-white black female that is that's part of her profession, and she basically instructs the young fellows on proper eating, you know, out of the public eating culture, that sort of thing, primarily from the standpoint of, you know, I mean, we're in the global system of racist white supremacy, so therefore whatever means to, in a lot of cases, to acquire, not acquire, but yes, to acquire a profession of some type, you may have to go to some sort of dinner or something of that like, and it'd be good that that person is skilled and knows how to navigate through that process. And that's basically what she does with that, because the next week they go to a restaurant. Most times Mr. Clark tries to take them to a restaurant that is black owned and operated. And they with their suits and ties, or sometimes he would have some sort of Afrocentric type of dress where they would go as a group and dine that evening. Instead, I went to visit my son's mother with my offspring. We went to visit her and got her to laugh. Got her to laugh, and basically she really appreciated us, you know, coming by on a regular basis. What else? But that's all I can think of right now. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Always
applaud folks having constructive time, hanging out with attempted family members. No conflict. That is outstanding. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, suggestions, questions, folks that we missed totally thus far, if you dialed in, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. This is the Mahandisi. I'm calling on a different number. Greetings. Greetings to everyone. I'm back in the States now, and I have a lot to say about the journey, but I'll save that until my thoughts are organized. I also wanted to speak about what was being discussed with the wheel. So I have some real estate experience, and as a realtor, we've been taught to follow people who have died, follow people who are getting divorced, because this is where your sales are absolutely going to come from, or not absolutely, but it's going to come from these particular situations. So there's people who, I don't know that they've been, well, actually, there's people who spend most of their profession doing that thing, estate sales, to whatever, however way they're doing it. Like, I've met people who are, they're working for an organization, and they take the estate, if you don't have plans, and they donate it to some type of nonprofit, or some way it works, it gets into the hands of, like, this organization. It's a white organization. And then there's also, I've met people who, you know, they go and that's where they're going to make their sale to another person, you know, regular citizen. You know, so they would get the house and they would list it because the person died. So, you know, something's going to happen to the house if there wasn't a will, especially if there wasn't a will. And then houses get taken. I think they call it intestate, which means that the state takes it back, or the white government owns it. So yeah, the will is definitely important. And just with the some of the experience that I've had, we've been taught, you know, that without the will, people can make a lot of business, other people who are outside your family. So yes, but I also just wanted to mention, just in general, for black people as a whole, there's a lot of this dissension in our global group, and that's unfortunate. It's really unfortunate, but we're absolutely going to have to ally. So, thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Much obliged, Imhan DC. Glad you have made it back safely, and hopefully you'll be able to collect your thoughts, organize your thoughts, and share once you can synthesize your conclusions of your travels. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
No, this is Red in Nevada.
Sorry.
It's all right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. A few things on some of the clips that I did hear. The first thing was on the clip about the two brothers in North Carolina with the property theft. And I know the white, if I'm not mistaken, the white woman who wrote the book or was doing the research, when she was giving one of the answers, she had said, instead of the racial wealth gap, she said the racial wealth crap, and then she almost like a Freudian slip. So I thought that was interesting because even though, you know, that was something like that's really, really subtle. When I was taking a psychology class and learning about Freud, those types of verbal errors may actually unintentionally verbalize what you are really thinking. And it kind of made me think about how when white people, they try to change a particular meaning of a movement or a term or what have you. I guess by movement, maybe like, you know, when people started out with the Black Lives Matter, quote unquote, movement, it turned into, you know, White Lives Matter and all this other stuff, All Lives Matter. But it makes me, whenever I think of wealth gap now, because of white women, I think of like the female wealth gap. I forgot what they termed it as, and having to retrain my thoughts to remember that, you know, of course, racism is always more oppressive than anything to do with what a man makes versus what a white woman makes. That was the main thing that it kind of, you know, all over the place. So I don't know. I can't. I'm sorry. I need more time to get my thoughts together about the other clips. One thing that I did want to mention from the book study, because I have been keeping up with it, especially I feel like the main thing that I've been able to retain from the book is listening to your intuition or any thoughts or inner guidance about a particular event or anything that's happening within your life. The reason why I bring this up is because I had decided to order some food, and instead of like having it delivered, I decided to go out and get it. And it wasn't extremely late, but it was late at night, but it was definitely dark outside. And I decided to go to the carryout place to get the food. And basically where I am in Las Vegas, is one of the places where I do regularly see homeless people and people on drugs roaming around. And because it's not necessarily an area that is overpopulated with white people, if an area is overpopulated with white people, no matter how much money they make, the law enforcement officials manage to, not allow the homeless people or the people who are on drugs to be over there. Anyways, I'm at the carryout place, and this person, I'm assuming he had to be on drugs. It was actually a black male. He came in singing. He asked for like a bag for some food that he had supposedly bought, but he didn't actually buy any food. And then there was kind of like a verbal altercation between him and this white woman cashier, and I'm just waiting on my food. And she says, well, you know, since if you don't want to get out, I'm going to call the police. And he's still kind of going back, and he's still not really wanting to exit the establishment. And the white woman, she says, well, I then have this wonderful witness here too, so if I call the police, there will be somebody to actually basically concur with what I'm saying about these events. And I'm glad that it didn't, you know, the black male, he did eventually leave, but I'm glad that it didn't, you know, turn into law enforcement officials being called, because I'm like, all I wanted to do was pick up some food and not turn into a witness and, for something that I really didn't, you know, want to be involved in. And that's not the only time that I've been having like an inner, I guess I would call it like inner guidance, to basically deter me from doing something that I probably should not have done or on my way to do. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red. Is that like a sign that you maybe shouldn't have eaten there, or what do you think?
I think it is a sign that I shouldn't have gotten any food from there, and it's a sign that I should not go out late. I know that's something that had been discussed on the Cows before with other, I think it was another black female who said she was out of the store and something might have happened or a minor altercation was happening. And she said that that's the reason why she probably shouldn't go out at night. Y'all meet my line. Mm-hmm.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. I think I've said it pretty bluntly over the years that I do pretty much recommend more prudish behavior in the system of racism, white supremacy, meaning avoiding being out super late and that type of thing, doing things that would call attention to yourself or might be a bit more dangerous. In fact, I think that is in concurrence with what is suggested in the book club, Gavin De Becker, The Gift of Fear, that was mentioned previously. But I think that is along similar lines and saying just if you kind of get a sense, hey, maybe this is not where I should be, maybe this isn't the type of person I should be kicking it with, listen to that, encouraging all of us to listen to that. I think especially, too, with food. Food is so important. It's what you put in your body. If you're getting some signals, some signs like, yeah, I don't know, maybe I should just stay in and get my Brussels sprout on at home or, you know, figure out something easy to whip up here, then might be one to listen to a little bit more. That is one that I abide by as well. I don't just come here and talk about drink water or take care of yourself. I routinely make an effort. If it's late, maybe you don't want to be kicking it, hanging out too late. Try to be in. I've even said that at times when I've been with other friends and such, and they're all about, like, yeah, we could go do this and go do that, and it's 12 and 1 o'clock. Like, whoa. Slow down. I do not think I'm going to be out gallivanting at midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning around Seattle. That is when a lot of mischief happens. Other folks, we got people that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, we haven't heard from you at all. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. The first segment I want to speak on is, I think that was the black male who said he grew up in the Chicago area. He was constantly being harassed by law enforcement, and he said he forgot. He just couldn't remember the amount of times. I guess it was happening that often. And I think that that behavior pattern of white people where when they're interviewing a victim of racism, they always in some form ask, well, what can we do or what is the solution? I wanted to point that one out, and I couldn't remember what his response was, but I mainly wanted to focus on that one from that segment. And I did catch the slip of wording, the racial wealth crap, and with the wills, as far as I know, when that comes to probate and estate and the distribution of assets, I have seen a couple of black people come in, you know, not really knowing how to get the property deeds done. And we've always been told, hey, you know, you can't give any advice, can't give any legal advice. Refer them to legal counsel. Tell them to pursue the advice of an attorney. So I think it's definitely white supremacy involved in that. And the person that usually is involved in helping to do the sale of, I guess, the tax deed sales, she's been rude to some black customers as well a couple months ago, where a black person came in and she needed help trying to figure out the information, at least on the scheduling of if she could even buy some property, and she didn't even want to help the person out. Like she was just acting like she was being bothered to even explain something to the person. And when she left, she was talking to another white person like, you know, I just don't get it. You know, I showed her what to do. If you have a hard time reading, you have literacy issues, you know, and that's your problem. So basically, racism, definitely you're going to have to encounter, and these are people, you know, of course, at the courthouse. My next one is, it was the segment where they were speaking about, I guess it was a play, about a black family, and the term overachieving was used. The daughter character was overachieving. I don't know if that's supposed to be something that's a compliment. I doubt that it is. Maybe that has something to do with the character's level of information or intelligence, or that she's educated or too educated or something. The segment about, I think it was the lady over in the Seattle area, she was talking about the sexism and racism. And I guess it was something about the Democrats' view on race. She was, someone was concerned about it being too divisive. And that can be a very vague term because you have Democrats and Republicans. So is that already being divisive? I guess is that acceptable? But when it comes to racism, it's not. And my last two one is the segment where, yeah, I think they were at the gun range, and the metaphor everyone's up in arms was used. So I think that one has something to do with what, firearms, up in arms, and anti-American was used. And they hate this country. I guess they were speaking about the non-white females and that work in the government. So, like, what is that supposed to actually mean? Like, where no one's asked the question, at least from the segments or the media that I've seen on the story, where did they say they hate America? You know, like, what does that mean? Or is that something they're coming up with? And the statement was used, the tweet, he said the tweet meant go back and fix your areas. When it came to explaining the don't throw rocks if you live in a glass house. But then he says, go back and fix your areas, and then you can come back and fix mine. So that's hypocrisy. So what areas you speaking of? And then the area you talking about, what is in that area? I mean, it just sounds like a bunch of confusion. The last one is where the guy was talking about him being frustrated, the president, not racist, and the people who shared his frustration, he was using coded language. He just vented his frustrations on the tweets, and he mentioned that the white males being present in the, I think, presidential debate, or the people who are running for president, I guess, he says he didn't think that was racist. So he tried to use an example of white men, I guess, running for the Democratic, I guess, nomination. He said he didn't think that was racist, that people was pointing that out. And my last thing is mainly, I haven't heard any white women really speaking out on this, because with Me Too and women's rights and things like that, but you have non-white females being victims of racism, and I haven't heard anything. So that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I think we heard about the courthouse during workplace racism. Got white women Trump supporters there. 52% white women voters supported Trump 2016. Probably will get the same and or more support this time around. But white women Trump supporters working at the courthouse might bump into one of them when you're going to get your necessary documents to get your will, get the property deed, and they're rude and callous to customers, might be another Trump supporter. Many different layers to how racism, white supremacy operates. That's why I said what is most to blame for black people not having that property is not, you know, niggers being shiftless and lazy about getting wills, racism, white supremacy. A lot of obstacles on the way even to getting that will sometimes. the up-in-arms metaphor, great catch. thought that was super important as well, at a gun range, no less, to make that sort of metaphor. Clearly, everybody is not, quote unquote, up in arms, if you mean firearms, certainly not, because you're only talking to one group that's at the blacksmith gun range in Montana. And I thought that also was a great comparison. That's why I say that every compensatory call-in, when we start making comparison contrast, say, well, I don't think, you know, what President Donald J. Trump had to say on his social media account, I don't think that was racist. And I don't think it was racist. The Democrats saying that, I don't think these white guys, I don't think they can be president. I don't think that's racist either. Even that being mentioned, even though he said he didn't think that that was racist, but that being brought up as an example of something that could potentially be racist, as though maybe these white guys are victims of racism because people are questioning whether or not they can be president. Maybe we don't need any more white guys to be president. Like, oh, you're practicing racism against Bernie Sanders. You don't want him to be president. You got to pick one of these non-white congresswomen or somebody else to be president. Important, I think, to catch those types of comparisons, contrast, especially when it could be contributing to confusion about what white supremacy racism is. We have any other folks that we missed totally? Other folks that have a hand up that we've not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Interesting, you was talking about wills, where the topic of wills came up. I know at a local radio station here in Chicago, there is a non-white black attorney who has a small law firm that handles the probate processes. And he gets on a weekly radio show on this radio station where he talks about a lot of the issues of people, or in particularly black people, without wills, and how their property or whatever estate has to go through the probate process. And he basically details a lot of things about it. And I know he kind of advertises his firm, you know, for services, but at the same time, he does inform people about the probate process and how. Now, he doesn't specifically say this, but he's indirectly saying how, you know, the white government or white people can, you know, take property of black people who, you know, don't even have a will. And the thing about it is, even in a will, this is what he says. I'm not an attorney or anything, but from what I've heard from him say on this show is that even in the will, it still has to go through the probate process. Now, what he did mention was there was a thing called a living trust that you can do, but I think it's for more expensive properties, because the thing about a living trust is the living trust not only just identifies who gets the property after the owner is gone, but it also avoids the probate process, and it also too identifies the beneficiaries even when, like, say the person is incapacitated or, you know, can't, you know, own the property or run the property anymore. So living trust, but the living trusts are very much more expensive. But yeah, I was just wanted to throw that out there in regards to that. And that's all I have right now. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Really important information. And these are just, in my view, these are important techniques, strategies that can be employed, not just, you know, to help if you want to make sure that, you know, whatever assets or what have you are transferred in an organized manner according to your wishes. But it seems like this can, in one way, minimize, eliminate some of the ways that white people practice racism, white supremacy, in creating conflict between other non-white people. I know I've observed personally, I mean, there can be some really bitter, nasty disputes once someone has passed away and that gets to be wrangling about who's going to get what. I mean, wow, like people can stop speaking, you know, for years permanently sometimes around all that. I mean, if that can be eliminated or at least greatly reduced, already have that taken care of, and at the same time can stop some of that squabbling and prohibit or at least minimize whites' ability to come in and thief property or cause dissension, outstanding. Look into that, share information on that. Hopefully that can be something we can add consistently to our counter-racist code. I'll give out the number again as we are encroaching on the conclusion of the broadcast, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Did we get everyone who dialed in with a hand up? Anybody we missed who had a comment, question, suggestion that they wanted to offer? Make sure we don't miss anyone. I will assume we nat. Did I hear someone? All right. I at least assume that we got everybody. Has anybody had any additional questions, comments they wanted to make sure they share before we wrap things up?
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York?
Yes, Gus. Yeah, I wanted to address the guy who said that he should bring someone on the show. He could look up on his own. Or you could just take what white people have told us. The WIC, which is the Dutch West India Company, look at the history of that, which is called New Netherlands, today called New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantation, because that's the actual name of Rhode Island. Also called New Amsterdam, which is the headquarters or the capital of that corporation, which is today called Manhattan. They also formed New Holland, which is today called Brazil. All their history is documented. And they describe the Americans quite well as Willie here or Locke here, Brady here. They also predate the English colonies here. These were formed in the early 1600s. They traded with the Americans that were here. They traded tobacco in the New Netherlands, and they traded sugar down in New Holland, which is Brazil, on the packaging of those products. To find on the Google search, you can find the boxes and the tins of tobacco covered with art depicting the Americans and the whites. Who were doing business with them, and not sleep yet. Also, the Americans in Brazil doing sugar on the bags of sugar, you can see what they look like. All the same look from North to South America. You also could get a book called America. America being the latest and most accurate depiction of the New World. It's full color illustrations inside the book. You get the original book by John Ogilvie, printed in 1671. It's on the Smithsonian website, at least it was. Another book you could get, last thing I'll say, is Washitanta. I can't pronounce it, but his name is W-H-A-N-S-T-A-C-H-A-N-A-H-P-K-O-N. K-A-N-Y-O-N. It's 103 amazing facts about Black Indians of the Western Hemisphere. It's $250,000 on Amazon if you trying to hide our history. But I have a PDF if you want it. It's not the best quality, but it's the book. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus. Oh, the Dutch, they also owned another company. It's the largest corporation ever created. It's called VOC, or the Dutch East India Company. The Dutch was a huge trading empire known as the Holy Roman Empire. time, but, you know, today they're called the Dutch. That's why we call them that. But look into their history, and you'll see what your original Americans look like, and they described them well. They did a lot of business with them. And I'm going on.
Can I be heard? Yes, sir. Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. We hear you, retired firefighter.
Sorry for cutting you off. I thought it was interesting. As I mentioned before, I for the most part, I kind of like am very selective about what I watch. And most of the programs that come on television, I don't go to the movies, but most of the television programs that happens during the quote-unquote regular channels, I don't watch at all. I hear it talked about on the program, but I don't even know the programs by name or what to watch, and it doesn't have an interest. But I watch documentaries, and as most of you know, racist white man, woman, and child has been basically bragging/celebrating. I believe what they identify as the 50th anniversary of quote unquote landing on the moon. If they did, a lot of people don't believe that they did land on the moon. I can believe that they did. White people are very adventurous and they take chances. So it doesn't ruin my sleep if they did land on the moon. But nevertheless, to build up to that point, they were talking about the history of the space quote-unquote program. And, of course, you know, during that particular all of that different viewings and whatnot, documentaries, they had to mention about the quote-unquote first black astronaut, black person to train as an astronaut. His name was, I had it right on the tip of my tongue, Dwight Edwards, I believe, or Edward Dwight. It was kind of like his name was kind of like a little bit unusual. Edward Dwight, I believe his name was. And he was actually picked by Robert Kennedy, according to what I think was the opinion of some white people, that he picked him because white people in the program did not want a black person, of course, to be a quote-unquote astronaut. But nevertheless, with that particular type of power, he was able to get into the training program. When they went down, I think it was with the Gemini version, not the first group, but the second group, which was the Gemini version. They had to. It's almost like NFL and cutting players, where they basically do the same things. At that time, with the space program, he didn't make the cut. But they were interviewing this white male who was the person in charge. He was a former astronaut himself, and I would wish that everybody would have saw the look on his face when they actually said. Asked the question this way. We hear that you had a Negro boy. Now, mind you now, Mr. Dwight was 29 years old with three children, married with three children. He was a fighter pilot, and he worked out of the historic Edwards Air Force Base, you know, basically flying airplanes to make them approval to the Air Force, which is actually taking a chance. He was doing all that, but he still was identified as a Negro boy. And stoically, the former astronaut in charge said, "No, we don't have a Negro boy with us." You know, as far as Chuck Yeager, the famous quote unquote Chuck Yeager, was actually very racist on. Mr. Dwight when he was in the program itself and didn't want him. It's similar to the supervisors that Charles Phillips mentioned with the fire department. It's basically the same type of racist trek that he had to go through. I thought it was quite interesting when I was watching. That's what I'm bringing it up, and that because it went on during the course of this week. They've been bragging about that for about maybe 2 weeks now. This whole space program thing, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
The New York Times had a big article on Ed Dwight in the paper. You can check it out. I was reading it online this morning, and it goes through all of the racism that he encountered. And just as retired firefighter just pointed out, the Kennedy administration's support of him and what was happening at that time. I'll post it so folks can share if they like. Reminded me of Dr. Welsing's brother-in-law that we've talked about before.
Right. He was killed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other folks who dialed in, much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks, last few minutes. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. But someone had brought up the play that was talked about during the clip. And how the daughter was mentioned as overachieving and how weird that was. So since it was a Brooklyn, that's where my mom's from, I looked for the play. I think this play is primarily for white people because of most of the prices. I think they have some days, I guess if you order it up in advance, the tickets are $55. But other than that, the tickets are $90, $100, $115. But that wasn't the main thing I saw. The description that the people because usually when you put something like this together, you put out your own description for the public, something that they can read and they decide they want to see it. I don't think this is something you would want to see based on the description, but I'm going to read it. It's pretty short. In Fairview, the Frazier family is gearing up for Grandma's birthday, and Beverly needs this dinner to be perfect. Plus, the radio's on the fritz, her sister Jasmine is drinking, her husband, Dayton, isn't helping. Her brother, Tyrone, might not show up at all. And her daughter, Keisha, is being a typical teenager. As Beverly's hostess neurosis begins to get the better of her while her family acts like family, Keisha's adolescent malaise starts to seem like maybe it could be something else. The description they give is a typical teenager. So I kind of want to see what is the difference between typical and overachieving. Did she just do all her homework? That person brought up a good point. Why is this young lady overachieving? And this sounds like, a family of pressures. Because Keisha's malaise, I don't know if she was attacked. But I don't know. It just sounds bad. But that is the description that they give.
The Negro trauma drama. We can hear you, Mr. Steele. Give me 1 second. The report that they wrote on Mr. Dwight, it's lengthy, so I'm not reading the whole thing. One paragraph. Dwight and his older sister integrated the local Catholic high school, though not before a blacks-only shower was built, and Dwight was lectured on not looking at white girls. He went out for the football team and boxed. It seemed the only thing that the diminutive teenager did not excel at was basketball, but he still played and didn't look at white girls, apparently. Mr. Steele, yes, sir.
That right there is a virtuous black man or a black male if he didn't look at any white women. That's very commendable on his part. But this is Ken Steele. I'm calling in from Los Angeles. I'm actually on Slauson Avenue. I just passed the Marathon store, and I'm looking at different places to rent because I took a look at a whole bunch of stuff happened, and that caused me to take a look at some of my finances from the past year, and I found out that I spent over $20,000 on rent last year alone. Over $20,000. And we were looking at some of the numbers, and with that same amount of money, I could have purchased a home in the Inland Empire, which isn't too far outside of Los Angeles. And I'm just seeing, you know, how some of the opportunities that we have and some of the moves that we can make can be completely oblivious to black people, even those of us who are so-called educated and are advantaged in materially, so to speak. And, you know, I was just looking at how much I spent, so I'm taking a look at different options and different places to live. And I have been, I looked in a predominantly black area here in Los Angeles. And just being in this area, one thing that I have noticed is that the signs that they have up in the stores are very oftentimes authoritarian and threatening. I was at a 7-Eleven that had a Chevron attached to it, and I looked in the window and I thought I saw a cop, and it wasn't a cop. It was a cutout of a cop, or it was a sticker of a cop, you know, telling me not to steal and, you know, keep my Negro paws off of the merchandise, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, this was extremely jarring, and I looked up, and I saw a large, very large billboard about HIV, this, that, and the other. And, you know, in my current place that I live, in the current area that I live, you don't see that sort of thing around. You don't see that sort of aggression in just the signage alone. And that's something that that just struck me as peculiar. And I don't know if the money I would save, by relocating completely to a whole different area of the city would be worth the psychological trauma that I can understand that this would eventually have on me. I don't know. I don't typically go to the store and see what looks like a cop yelling at me, but if I relocated to this area, that would be normal to me. Somebody was mentioning that the theory that black people are somehow indigenous to the United States, or the people that we classify currently as black ourselves and others are somehow indigenous to the United States of America. You know, there is a lot of confusion surrounding the origins of black people all over the world. I was looking up origins of Igbo people, the tribe that I am affiliated with, or that I'm from, or I don't know how to articulate that, but this tribe that I have like a genetic affiliation to. I was looking up, hey, where are the origins of the Igbo people? And all I could find were materials that referenced the Bible and, you know, theories about how Igbo are descended from Jews, even though that we're we are older than the story of Abraham. Look, there is a lot of confusion about where so-called black people are from, and I don't know if there is a one place that black people are from, but I do know that there are a lot of lies out there that are based on theories that are either originally put out by people who are classified as white, or they are pushed by people who are classified as white, and oftentimes I think a lot of these origin stories are there to confuse us. I honestly have no idea. And if you ask, where do the supposed people who are from where slaves come from or whatever, we don't know where we're from either. So I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. We did our 3 hours plus a little bit extra. Hopefully it was worthy of everyone's time and energy. Folks can remain safe for the remainder of your weekend. Do some research, perhaps. Do some reading. Reading is more important than watching television. If you check out any of the projects, if you check out the play Fairview that was mentioned, that word fair, any of the museums, any of the books that were referenced, feel free to let us know. Actually, the astronaut, Ed Dwight, actually wrote an autobiography, Soaring on the Wings of a Dream. Soaring on the Wings of a Dream. Ed Dwight, if you want to check out what he had to say. I'll give a last paragraph as we wrap things up. This is from the New York Times report on Ed Dwight. After a weekend of press events, Dwight would fly back to base, where his classmates had been hitting the books to prepare for the week ahead. In addition to speeches, he faced the all-too-typical travails of a black serviceman of his generation. When the test pilot students traveled for training, waiters refused to serve him. Cars left without him, and hotel rooms were mysteriously not booked. The combination of public appearances and private indignities was weighing on Dwight. The disadvantage I had was all the other guys in this program didn't have that distraction. Dwight said, I've got to get up the next day and have an exam and deliver the goods and let them know that I'm equal to the other guys who didn't have to go make 10 speeches that weekend. But the only other thing waiting for Dwight on Monday was Yeager. Every week, right on the dot, Dwight recalled, he'd call me into his office and say, are you ready to quit? This is too much for you, and you're going to kill yourself, boy. Calling me a boy, and I'm an officer in the Air Force. I'll stop there. I'll share the New York Times article so you can read it in its entirety if you would like. But that is on Ed Dwight. Incidentally, I have heard with all the talk about the moon landing and such, lots of talk about the earth being flat and white people have lied about that. Particularly, I've talked to quite a few victims of racism who normally don't talk about counter-racism or racism, white supremacy at all. But they have had quite a bit to say about the earth being flat and white people lie about that. Yes, white people lie about many things. They also can get us distracted on many things. I think the caller in Alabama questioned before and said, hey, question everything. White people do lie about lots of things. I would put out a bit of caution. Sometimes that can just be a distraction. We do have limited time and energy. Be cautious about how we invest our time and energy. With that, much obliged for folks participating. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let's try as best we can to preserve our brain computers so that we can efficiently come up with new solutions, techniques to solve the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, including staying off the cell phone behind the wheel. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.